Okay, this is Bob Dobbs, and I'm talking with John Corcelli. Or is it Corcelli, John?
It's Corcelli formally, yes.
Okay, Corcelli. John Corcelli, who I think has produced the latest book on Zappa, pretty recent. It's copyrighted in 2016. It's called Frank Zappa FAQ, subtitled All That's Left to Know About the Father of Invention. Now, John, what I enjoyed about the book is I wasn't keen on reading another Zappa book because they tend to run over the same stories. I found Barry Miles' books interesting. Maybe we'll get into that for a different reason. But when I saw that you did a book, and we had met at CKLN 30 years ago, 84, 85, 86, somewhere in there.
Yes.
And I didn't know you were a fan of Zappa, and you didn't know I was, I don't think. And so we never talked about it back then. But, yes, you want to go ahead?
Yes, you're so far so good.
Okay.
Go on. Yeah.
So I started to read your book, you know, thinking this could be boring. But then what I appreciated as I got through it, moved through it, was there's a lot of stuff, and it's obvious, but there's a lot of stuff that's happened since 1993. And I don't know many books deal with that. You organize all the stuff since then, even dealing with people who have died, you know, former musicians of his colleagues in that. There's a lot of stuff 23 years, that has to be organized, and that's what I enjoyed about your book. Do you see your book doing that?
Oh, thank you very much, Bob. I do now. I think that many of the compliments that I have been given, either professionally or personally, have agreed with you, in particularly in the chapter regarding his alumni and the other band members,
yeah.
and putting that into context where people are now since 1993. Also, of course, the although it's out of date now, the discography is brought up to date for a lot of people too, oddly enough.
Yes. No, that's really good because I have been buying stuff over the last 20 years from Zappa.com or Zappa Records or whatever Gail ran.
Yes.
And I was unaware of the amount of stuff that had been revealed or been released. And when I started thinking about buying stuff about a year ago, there was too much. I didn't know where to begin. And
indeed,
I didn't have time to go to a consumer guide. But in a way, you provide a consumer guide.
Well, I hope to bring people into the music. So not just to do a listing and not to go into too much comprehensive study of his work, but to sort of point out that when you're dealing with over 100 different recordings, that can be overwhelming for a lot of new people. So my goal was to sort of discern for me what I felt would be the best ways to get into the music. And then once people sort of got into that portal, as it were, or
yeah,
through the door that way, that they could discover the rest on their own.
Yes.
Much like you and I did when we were first hearing this music, you know, back in the day.
Well, it was great. I didn't buy albums, basically, you know, from the 60s on, but I always bought Zappa. Whenever anything came out, I bought them.
Yeah.
So now those vinyls are very valuable because, you know, everything got obsolete, but to have the vinyl album covers, the book, the notes and all that, it's better than the CD, you know, tininess of, you know, of the booklets. So I'm glad I bought, and I picked the right guy, which leads to buy, I think, and or, you know, have developed a fetish over. So I say this to people. First of all, and you don't have to respond to this one, but I say that Zappa is the greatest composer in history. So, and then I add, when people say, why, what do you mean? I say, because he took advantage of the technology that was coming forth in this great century, or 20th century, and he applied it immediately, meaning that he included future developments in music just because he was so ahead of everybody.
Yes.
So the fact that he exploited the present was significant as for his greatness. But then when I see the statement by, I think it's page 269, Jerry Bogus Pomp. He has a very good statement. There is absolutely no doubt that Zappa will eventually be placed alongside his classical music contemporaries, where he deserves to be. I truly feel that he was the greatest composer since electricity changed music. That's a more precise way to say it. I still think he's great on the big level, but that's a great statement. Now, I'm asking you now, do you agree with that? that Zappa's the greatest composer since electricity changed music.
Wow. I think it's a very profound statement.
Yeah.
I think that thinking about it here and now and today, I would be hard-pressed to find any kind of equivalent composer, either dead or alive, who was able to bring so much together.
Yeah.
And to I guess, I don't want to use the word synthesize, but I guess that's the only word that I can come together with all of his disparate interests in music, and to put it all together the way he can made him a truly great composer.
Yeah.
You know, like you can get a certain composer might be able to recreate doo-wop songs really well, or, you know, 20th century modal compositions or 12-tone compositions. They might do that very well. They might be able to sync together spoken word elements really, really well. You might get someone who can do classical things or chamber music and write that very well, or write pieces for large ensembles really, really well. But you could never, I guarantee you, you can't find one person who could do all of that very well.
No.
And that's why we love Frank so much, and why his music is so, rewarding.
Yeah.
Particularly as we get older, I don't know about you, but as I've gotten older, I've begun to appreciate his work much, much more, simply because I know more about the music that he's tapping into now, more so now than I did when I was 16. I had no idea.
Yeah.
I mean, of course not. My musical education was very, very limited at 16. I knew rock and roll, and I knew humor and music, and I knew, you know, the blues. But I never understood what Frank was on about. But I was able to find those hooks and hear those hooks based on my limited knowledge that drew me in, made me lean forward. And now that I'm much older, I have certainly in a better position to appreciate,
what he did,
and to think that he was the greatest composer since electricity changed music, I think it was one of the nicest things you could say about him.
Yeah, yeah.
No question.
And the reason I say he's the greatest in history is that it's been such a fantastic century for pre-record, pre-electric, and electric. The music is tremendous. McLuhan even said, and, you know, he's an old guy, born in 1911. He said, he and Ted Carpenter said, any pop music, top 40 stuff is way better than any Mozart or anything. So why is he saying that? The fact is that the music is actually the content of an electronic experience. What McLuhan says, what Zappa says in his Life magazine article, the conductivity, the bone conduction. See, so electrified music is different from anything before electricity. But Zappa he understood that and therefore didn't have any limitations of what he could do with the content. So the whole world was available for him to play with. That's why he becomes the greatest, because he took advantage of what's happening now that no other composer had.
Exactly. I don't disagree with you on that one, Bob. I think that's a very good assessment and understanding it in contemporary terms.
Right. And that turns out to be more a more relevant attitude, because basically composing is obsolete by the mid-90s, and anybody can do anything. So Frank is like the last composer of the humanist kind, and maybe even anarchist kind, but whatever. He's the last authoritarian intelligence or authority of knowledge. And after that, music's obsolete in a way. Composing's obsolete. Now, he included in his definition of composing running for president. See,
that's right.
What even makes it even greater, his broad definition of what he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I say he's the greatest, you know, and there's so many people who wouldn't agree with that. But the other statement is, a friend told me that music historians, if there are any in, you know, 100, 200 years, will name the past 40 years, say, the Zappa era. What do you think of that statement?
Well, I'd like to see the evidence for that, but, I mean, I'd be curious to know if they want to call it the Zappa era. We would have, that would, you know, that sounds like a university course of some kind.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, where are the Zappa inspired composers? We know the musicians are out there. We know that the musicians who played with him, as well as even his offspring, understand what they're carrying with them. But is there anybody who is sort of being able to express themselves in a musical format, or to run for president, or with a sense of humor, or any kind of compositional skill to bring it all together, as you suggest? If they are, we either they're working in obscurity, or they don't exist.
Yeah, they're Bruce Bickford, a Bruce Bickford kind of guy, you know.
Ah, there you go. Yeah, Bruce Bickford kind of guy. They're in a tiny garage, modeling clay, and taking it one frame at a time. And then in 10 years, they got a 5-minute animated feature, you know, and it's like, God bless you for that.
Yeah, that gets played once on college radio.
Yeah, that's right. That's the only time, yeah.
Yeah, so what was my point there? The what I mean by the Zappa era, what this guy might have meant, I've talked about it with him. Look at the wah-wah pedal. There's a new article just came out the other day. It's the 50th anniversary of the guy who invented the wah-wah pedal.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, if you haven't seen it, I'll send it. And he invented very near Frank. It's a garage in Hollywood Hills.
Ah.
Now, Frank heard about it, came over and introduced himself, and then started working with it,
right,
and turned Hendrix onto the wah-wah pedal.
Ah, that doesn't surprise me.
But see, look, here's Hendrix. He's known as an awesome wah-wah guy, and maybe he put it on the map, and nobody knows that Frank got him into it.
No, nobody would know that.
See, there's the influence I'm talking about. And he's so influential on Adrian Belew and everybody else that came through.
Yeah.
I mean, he influenced Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band and all that stuff, if it's true what he's saying in his interaction with Paul McCartney and his other statements he makes about it. He influenced so much technically that that's why he is, in a technology era, that's why he is it's going to be his era, his Zappa era, because he was working on that level so strongly and ahead of everybody.
Mm-hmm.
There's a guy named Kenny Schaefer I met in New York City who made the first wireless microphone or something. I'd have to go back and read the details, but you can look it up. Kenny Schaefer, New Yorker, did an article on him. Who did he go to try it out with? Frank Zappa. That's
no
who first used it.
Really? Well, I think there was obviously a community of inventors, if you like.
Yeah.
That, I guess, understood or knew that Frank was certainly interested in new technologies. I mean, he was the first guy who spent a ton of money on one of the very first Synclaviers, and I know you've talked about that in the past, but for him to gamble on such a technology, think about that, knowing that it wasn't just the technology in and of itself, but a means to an end, and that means was, I don't have to hire a band anymore to play my music. I have a device which will actually print out the charts, or if not that, will take real samples and convert them into music any way I can, so that I don't have to have a drummer repeating the pattern over and over until they get bored, is that I can actually have them doing something that's repetitive but will do it forever without any qualification or without complaining or a break or any salary. And so I think that one of the things that Frank, that I certainly believe in, was the fact that he was pragmatic, but he was pragmatic out of necessity. The necessity to compose and to do it, and as he said, just to hear the music that was in his head. And that combination, I think, attracted, getting back to your first point, about the notion of technology, and that inventors could easily go for him, because maybe, you know, the invention of the wah-wah pedal created a sound or something that would have appealed to Frank as a guitarist, right? To get a certain sound or a certain feel or whatever the case may be out of his instrument. But then it would have had other applications as well.
Right, and there's a quote. James Brown was introduced to it around that time, and he said, why would anybody do that to their guitar?
Exactly.
You know, he didn't understand what it could be. So to supplement that, the Synclavier, what do I want to say about that? It's maybe hard for people, younger people, to understand it now. But back then, the big risk that was taking, the big risk that it was taking was that people thought it was cold and inhuman.
That's right, yes.
You know, what a risk, because, I think my first reaction was it wasn't that great when I first heard whatever came out first in 85 or so,
yeah,
in 83. Maybe it was Francesco Zappa, that album. But it was mechanical sounding or something. Now,
it sounded electronic. It was electronic music that sounded that way, and that's rather than musical.
Yeah, and many people, for the average person, consumer, music is fun, partying. Why would you get rid of humans, you know?
Why would you replace you know, the human element with something else?
In your band. So that's just citing that as the risk-taking he took.
And he took you're quite right. And then in his 1988 tour, he actually took that on the road with him. There's a computer, of course, on the Broadway, the hard way, there's pictures of that. But there was actually, he took on a computer at that time to make certain sounds that we would
call
up.
That's what turned me on. That's where he converted me on that tour. I saw many of the concerts that year, and I loved whenever the sounds were coming in from, he's sitting there, playing with a clavier. That was just awesome. Yeah. Then I saw the relevance of it, or it wasn't mechanical. It was within a bunch of humans, but it really added something.
And then later on, he was able to find real instrumentation, as what the kids now call sampling.
Right, right.
As to making real sounds, like on the last album that he did, there are samples of Ruth Underwood on the vibraphone, where she went in and just recorded a whole bunch of stuff. Well, then you can hear those. You can hear those sounds recreated on his 100th album, and it's like. We get it. You know what I mean? The human element was always there in some
We had a lot of cliches about it, just reading about it. We had no experience with it. So we just heard the traditional cliche, Orwellian, science fiction, Frankenstein takes over. But what was that? You were just saying human
element. About the human element and...
Oh, yeah. No, here's what I want to say is...
Yes.
You take Finding His Wake by James Joyce. 99% of his language no one recognizes because he made polyglot puns on over 60 languages.
Wow.
But as language mutates, whatever's going to happen to it over the next 500 years, what Joyce laid out may happen, may be understandable. So you apply that to Frank. As electric media, and I was McLuhan's archivist, so I bring a lot of McLuhan into it. And McLuhan understood that there's going to be need for content in all this gaping maw of television, radio, and the computer. Someone's going to keep putting stuff in. So that means anybody can get on there and provide distraction for 3 minutes or something. So if you understand electric media is needing any sounds and new sounds, Zappa fits the bill. He knew the thing was to make new sounds and not follow any genre's rules. He was providing content with the technology that could do it to fill in the gaping maw. He just actually, on top of it, orchestrated to some kind of abstract synthesis or point he was making about physics and matter and sociology. He even had a concept to go with it. But to remain relevant, he had to be open to making new sounds because the media was ready to process new sounds. The audience was, the global audience. That's what I think he understood. He understood that, hey, anything can be done here, so I'll just take the latest gadgets and see what I can tweak.
Exactly. Can you imagine what he would be doing now if he was still with us, with the internet the way it is and with the opportunity to create new sounds and ideas as long as he wanted without the restrictions of, say, the album concept, right?
Well, okay.
Those kinds of concepts. It leaves me breathless to consider what we would be hearing from him now.
Okay.
And how
we
would be hearing from him now, too.
Beg your pardon?
How would he be hearing from him?
He'd always be using the latest whatever. He'd be present himself as a hologram in some way, probably. Which he apparently was starting to intuit with Diophile. If I remember, there was some kind of projection from a studio they were going to do. They were going to do it from the studio, the Mothers. His band.
His band,
In the outline of Diophile. But... here it is. In 90, the music industry, I don't know where it was, because there's always young kids love music. But for the older people, the baby boomers, Generation X, it might have been in the doldrums in the early 90s. So Frank, being a little bored with the music industry, starts going into politics. Now, if he had pulled that off, even became a mayor of Los Angeles or something, I don't know what he would have done in music. But when the music explodes, well, whatever you can do, making the synclavier obsolete by 2000, that might have inspired him to do incredible stuff that he might not have wanted to do in 1990. Do you know what I mean? The technology improved over the next 10 years.
In other words, when it comes to composition, sometimes the technology is ahead of you, but then sometimes you have to wait for the technology.
Right. So he was waiting, and he went into politics.
Mm-hmm.
And that would have been really interesting because he understood.
Oh, yeah.
You know what that McLuhan said? The way you run a campaign is you don't have these people going out and going to towns and pressing babies, kissing babies and pressing hands.
Pressing the flesh, yeah.
You just have maybe back then, he was saying this in the 70s, you have Jimmy Carter and whoever he ran against.
Ronald Reagan.
Ford.
The first time. Gerald Ford, yeah.
You would have them just in a TV studio, maybe once a week, responding to the issues of the day. Not this planned, you know, up against in a podium and you got to have a standard position about something and you worry about whether you flub it. Have them in casual conversation and dealing with the issues. He said that in a TV studio. That's how you'd run a presidential campaign if you want to get public interest. Well, Frank almost took that idea. He said, I'm going to run it from my home. I'm just going to be available for, you know, countless interviews.
Right.
So he actually was intuiting how to do it. And with a low budget.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Because he didn't. If he was to run for president and they took a look at it, he still had the unfortunate, well, I wouldn't say unfortunate, but the pragmatic issue to deal with, and that was to get his name on every ballot.
Yeah.
And that would have cost a lot of money, apparently.
Yeah, he told this guy, Bob Beckel, was on Crossfire back in those days, mm-hmm. CNN's Crossfire, and that's who Zappa consulted with. And he said, Zappa came out after talking to Bob Beckel, that this election thing is so Byzantine, I don't know if it's worth it, you know. And so he was maybe not going to do it, but then the cancer came up. The exclusive on my Ike Willis interview, which was done in 2011, my long one, five-hour one, is that Frank, if you haven't heard it, you don't know, that Frank told him in January 89 he had cancer.
I believe I didn't hear that, but yeah, in 1989. Well, I know that in Greenaway's book, Andrew Greenaway's book, I don't know who he talked to. Probably was Ike, actually, that mm-hmm. even coming off the 88 tour, that he wasn't really feeling that great.
Oh, is that right? I haven't read it though yet.
Yeah, I can't find the actual quotation, but there was. The at least the suggestion that many of the people in the band could see that he wasn't feeling very well. And, of course, he went with a misdiagnosed prostate issue for the longest time. They didn't even know what he had.
Right.
When by the time they discovered it was too late.
Yeah, Ike says that's the reason.
January of 89 sounds about right.
Yeah, and, you know, it's not public announced for another two and three-quarter years.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Fall of 91. But what Ike said is that Frank, he had to be responsible to Ike. He said, look, don't count on me touring again. This is going to be a problem. You got to figure out what you're going to do. You know, and
right.
I think he had moved to Portland, Oregon or something. And so, you know, he appreciated Frank giving him a heads up on that. But that's why he found out, because he was hanging around Frank a lot. So Frank had to tell Ike. And, okay, so there's a whole thing we develop about, but you have to hear the dialogue to go into it. I won't go into it now, but just a side thing. Maybe that's why he didn't mind breaking up the band, you know, just letting the Scott Tunis thing take over, and he stopped touring because he didn't feel well.
Yeah, there's a good possibility, you know.
Yeah. So we agree that Zap is important, really important, and now, what do you think Frank's conceptual continuity was about?
Well, it was about him.
Yeah.
It was about him as the artist and basically creating the center of his own universe. That's part of it. And I think by the notion of conceptual continuity, I think really, really helped him understand his own art. I know that sounds a bit sophisticated, but if you are someone who has all of these diverse interests, if you are someone who is interested in using any technology available to you to express an idea, if you understand that the world is a global village, as it were, and electronically connected, I think it's really, really important to have your own philosophy of artistic expression, or some overarching notion of what it is you, in fact, do. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that you have to have this as an artist or a composer in order to be successful. But I think in the case of Frank, because of so many, because his work is so layered and so complex at times, that it's really fun to sort of organize it in a certain way. Now, he always pointed this out to this, what he called the Zappa freaks, the fans who are always looking for connections within his work.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether or not he was just playing everybody because he found a lot of humor in that people would really say, well, this is connected to that, it's connected to that. But my guess is that it was intentional in order to keep it all together. And I think that the albums are not individual pieces of work in and of themselves, unlike Joni Mitchell, who thinks of her albums as individual and complete works in and of themselves. The only connection to them is her.
Yeah.
Well, that's true. But in the case of Zappa, yeah, it's all related. Like, there's hints here and there. And he was able to at least get the help of his, you know, his art directors and everything else to sort of put it all together for him. Is this the way that I sort of see it?
Right. Okay.
Is this the way you see it?
Well, a couple of quotes. I have a pretty good memory for a lot of things he said, and so things pop into me as you talk. So one quote is back about 1973 in, I think, a Wee magazine interview, one of those magazines. He says, look, basically, it's all an extension of me.
Yes.
So your idea that that's a conceptual continuity is about me. But there are other interesting statements he made. At the end of my interview, my and Bob Marshall's interview, I asked him some big pointed question, and I said, what's your ultimate message? And he says, the emperor has no clothes. So that's another aspect of a big level. Then I remember reading years ago, there was two parts in the brain. There's the part that looks at particulars, and then there always has to be the second part is looking at the framework, the big meaning.
Right.
So here's Frank with an incredible genius dealing with particulars, but it's natural to have a big picture fitting the details into or molding it or containing it. He actually acted out the process of cognition, the process of the brain, the process of perception or consciousness by, his details, which allowed for a lot of improvisation and change, but there was a larger framework, which he called the big note or different things.
Yeah.
Then there's this quote, which I can never find again, but I remember around 1970, I was in a drugstore, and there was some little history of rock and roll or something, and there was an interview with Zappa, and in it he says, and I'm pretty sure this is what he said, because why would I forget and how would I otherwise know it, he says music is way behind the other arts, way behind literature, sculpture, painting. He lists off all the old what I call Gutenberg arts, and he says, we need to catch music up. Now, I later got a chance to ask him about Finnegan's Wake, and he says, yes, Finnegan's Wake, he said, I don't know why anybody published that.
Hmm.
And so I thought he was dismissing it, but later I found out that he meant he's amazed at the risk-taking of the guys that did publish it.
Good point.
So he actually was impressed with it, and he said, he wasn't an expert on James Joyce, and Ben Watson got a little bit about what did Frank say? He looked at Ulysses or something, looked at a couple of pages, says, yeah, that guy does it right, then put the book down, you know? And so, but Frank actually had an intellectual system or some kind of framework, and then you get into his interest in physics. So you see on Uncle Meat in the booklet, references to the Mu Meson, is it?
Mm-hmm.
The Mu Meson is mentioned in the booklet. But here's a quote that I don't think many people know, and the footnotes to the Bob Marshall interview were never available. The guy who transcribed it for the internet lost them or didn't have them. I can't remember. So I eventually found them and put out a new version of it and put on the internet. So listen to this. It seems to be Vogue magazine in 1972 on page 158. I don't know what month it is.
Mm-hmm.
It says, I have my footnote, this article was part of a column called Close Up, subtitled On Zest in the West, Rocking in the Sun. So something about people having a good time in the West Coast by Edwin Miller. So under the topic heading Philosophy, here's what Zappa said. quote, "I believe the basic stuff of the universe is in the shape of waves, not subatomic particles. Then, if the two components of the universe, waves and time, are actually one, and if a wave equals a wave, all time equals all other time, and you aren't going nowhere because you've already been there." "Viewing this whole mechanism from a distance, it would just be a solid object." Now, isn't that an incredible quote?
Yeah, that is, especially the last part. He actually identifies it as a solid object.
Right, and then you think of project object. That term, project slash object. But
yes.
the thing was, you know, they talk about Back to the Future, and some sophisticated physicists will talk about, yes, well, everything's already happened. We've already been there. The neutrino might be referring to that. But Frank understood that. He put together this, you know, little formula, and he comes up with, you're going nowhere because you've already been there. The already been there, that's pretty ahead of its time to say that.
Yes.
And then remember he says in one of the later interviews, the big important thing is the when, not the what and the where. He talks about W-H-E-N, the when. So that's timing, and that's what you do. When if you're not going anywhere and everything's canceling out, then all you've got is not time, but you've got timing and
timing.
Proportionality.
Yes, yes.
So here's Zappa saying something about science and ideas and philosophy. See, so therefore he was thinking on that level, and he wanted his work to reflect that as well as the pragmatics of performing every night. Which is another,
right.
In the electric age, you got to come up with stuff every night, and that allowed him to improvise, and he was into that, and make stuff that satirized the local audience. He always could do that. You know, you don't see Frank Sinatra in 1955 touring the world making fun of the local scene, right?
No,
in his song.
Not at all.
But
not
it's a different world by the time Frank Jr. comes along, and with the technology, and this is my point, he knew how to make fun with it and include the audience. And that was another aspect that was new for a composer. He wasn't an ivory tower guy. You know, I have done this long dialogue about Zappa with a couple of Zappa scholars. And I begin by playing John Adams. I think that's his name. He's an American composer.
Yep.
You ever heard of him?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, he's well known.
Nixon in China.
What?
He wrote Nixon in China, among other things. Yes.
Okay.
The opera?
Yes. You don't mean Einstein on the beach. This is Nixon in China.
No, that was Philip Glass.
Yes, that's right. No,
he wrote Einstein on the beach. Yeah,
that's what I guess that was Adam's response, you know, go to the low. Not Einstein on the beach, go to an asshole in China. I am not a crook. So the... what was I? Okay, so I begin with this quote, and he's there saying, you know, he really values what he does, but he's up against the popular love of his era for pop music and rock music and everything else.
Right.
He can't get a big audience. And so I start off with that because there is the crux. That's why he's not a great composer. Frank figured out how to do both, not be sort of pissed off and sort of like semi-complain about the condition of the audience and what they like, and he's hoping to get his stuff played somewhere that some people will notice. See, that's the division there. Frank was not trying to be that kind of preservation of ancient classical music, even though he was conceptually. In many ways, I mean, it's a great idea that the blues singers were doing Sprech Stimme, or solving the problem of words versus song. You've ever read that quote? Where he felt the blues singers solved the problems that Karl Orff and Bartok were working with as they tried to bring in speech elements into their composing.
Oh.
Yeah, that question, which was part of, you know, early modernism, he felt the blues singers solved it. Now, just that is a pretty interesting idea.
Yes,
you know,
it is.
That Frank was looking at it. But if you're going to be judgmental and elitist or white boy about your musical preferences, you'll end up in a problem like John Adams.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Yeah, and like go ahead.
Well, I was just going to suggest that I think your observation is quite correct regarding Frank's approach and the fact that he wrote this kind of stuff sometimes in spite of the audience or the reaction that he was expecting. But for, I guess, in the case of what John Adams has said, I don't know how he feels about it now, but for him to kind of limit himself and realize, oh, I can't compete with that, or I can't
I don't know how to make music relevant.
I don't know how to make music like that. Is fine, but the fact of the matter is that Zappa had the ability, as we now know, to embrace it. It wasn't like he always talked about, there is an audience out there for my particular form of entertainment, and that's the audience that he spoke to, and that's the audience that listened, and he understood that. He also and I think that was very, very important. I don't know if Adams sort of fully understands who he's writing for.
Right.
And when he says something like that, like, who are you writing for then? I mean,
he's writing for the little blue-haired ladies live in the past.
I guess so. And that's sad in a way, because the guy is actually not a bad composer, if you've ever heard any of his work. Some of his stuff is pretty good.
Yeah.
But, you know, for him to even write Nixon in China, you'd think that would have opened the door to, I don't know, Reagan at the Berlin Wall or something.
Reagan at Bitburg, or
something about your next president, that kind of thing. But I always find it interesting when composers of any kind of make excuses for themselves.
Yeah.
But what is their level of expectation? You know, Frank's level of expectation was basically to fund the next project.
Yeah. Have enough to get to the next project.
And whatever that means.
Does that mean
going on tour in Europe to raise money for the next record? Or does that mean, you know what I mean? Whatever it is. So his... I think the fact that he kept it small, if you like, allowed him to write all of this stuff. I mean, John Adams will never have over 100 albums in his discography.
Right.
It just ain't going to happen. Right?
That's right.
Because he wasn't as infatuated with either, certainly archiving it, but also the notion of getting as much material out there, be it on audio tape or film or videotape, all of those things. What drove Frank, doesn't drive every composer, if you know what I mean. This desire to hear.
Well, Frank was more than a composer. He was a scientist. He was a thinker. He was a politician.
Indeed. And he understood that, based on, our first part of this discussion regarding conceptual continuity, he understood that having conceptual continuity gave him the license to pursue all of these things as he wanted.
Yeah. It's all okay. About John Adams, his audience is New York City or the bigger cities with their publicly funded orchestras. You know,
right.
It's a limping along operation, classical
is
music,
ever?
For his audience.
Yeah.
And so it's a very defensive, bunker mentality.
Yeah.
And why would one want to create, what are you obsessed with to think that, well, that's a worthwhile audience. We must preserve these people that... went to school in the 30s and 40s and 50s and grew up with the classical music and didn't listen to rock and roll or Elvis. We must serve them. Yeah, but that's not a comprehensive artist, which has to go beyond being an artist, which Zappa did. See, that's why he's going to be the greatest historical, the guy, this Zappa era, because as many artists moved into multimedia, think of David Bowie or Crossover, that's what an artist had to do.
Exactly.
He would not be a specialist. And Frank he out non-specialized more than anybody. He would even do stupid stuff. He even specialized.
True.
It took a day or two to do stupid, ridiculous stuff, as well as everything else, plus not just politics. And when I give you this quote from this magazine from 1970, he's thinking about, science.
Yes.
And this is what, in my talk with Ike Wills, he says, there was a lot of books around Frank's studio. He was reading and keeping up on stuff. He was interested in Pons and Fleischmann's Cold Fusion when that came out in 1989.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. That said somewheres. He never followed up on much of it, but there is a quote or two. He says, I'm interested in this new thing that those guys up there in Utah came up with. But
right.
And then Ike is good because he witnessed all this, and he knows Frank had these interests. So he was a Renaissance or some kind of new electronaissance man, not Renaissance.
There you go. That's a good way to put it. Sure.
Yeah. So Now, back to its conceptual continuity. So conceptual continuity has, for me, many levels. It encompasses any specialism or interpretation you could put on it. For example, the referring to motifs that repeat. Okay, that's one kind. That's actual idea continuity, conceptual. But he also means keeping himself going, surviving. So he's a concept, and he's a united mutation? He's an international intercontinental absurdity that must keep going. And he says somewhere when they're complimenting and this and that, you know, way down the line, 25 years later, he says, well, if you do something like I did and never give it up, you're going to get acknowledged eventually. So he didn't even celebrate that it was a great achievement. It's what will happen if you can keep going, if you can be continuous. You will get acknowledged eventually.
Right.
I mean, we know how obscure he was. And there he comes on, Johnny Carson, in the late 80s, and they ask him what he is. He says, I'm a national treasure. Everybody said, wow, we don't even know who this guy is. But he was. See, people, this is what's interesting. He was an anti-environment to the information, glut of information, because here he was, a great phenomenon no one knew about. And he was hidden and a big influence.
Right.
And when you read that book, when I have it over here, have you read, what's it called, Zappa and Jazz by Jeff Wills?
Oh, yes. Yes, I have.
That's a good book for showing his involvement with jazz musicians. You know, just emphasize that part. The guy, he should have been awarded Downbeat stuff many times. But
absolutely. Yes. But
Downbeat didn't know that he was what he was doing. They couldn't see him. He's too big. He was not categorized as just a jazz guy.
No, not at all.
You know, eventually they did a few awards, but when you
he got some stuff. He'd only won a couple of things in the Reader's Poll and the Critics Poll.
Right.
And then after his passing, he made the Hall of Fame and all of that. But again, you know, as it comes,
Hall of Fame?
The jazz, yeah, the Downbeat Jazz Hall of Fame.
Okay, yes,
The Downbeat Magazine.
One. Right.
I think it's important to note that sometimes, try as these magazines do, they do actually, on one hand, they foster the art form, but on the other hand, they're still very narrow about its definitions.
Yeah. Yeah, right? They're just as bad as the blue-haired ladies or that market, you know.
In a way, yes. I mean, this is what I think what troubles a lot of people when it comes to a lot of music. Now, I've always felt that, and I used to work in a record store. And
I used to go to the record store and see you there.
There you go. And it was like everything has a category. And here I am sitting in Toronto, and I'm here in my work studio in my office here. And I got my collection of LPs here. And many people would actually put their music or their LPs into different sections. Comedy, classical, rock, jazz, blues, etc. I don't list it that way. I just do it from A to Z.
By name.
It's all mixed together, right?
By artist.
By artist.
Yeah.
I don't care. I tell people that if I decided to open my secondhand record store, you wouldn't know where the jazz stuff was.
That's a good idea.
I said, well, Louis Armstrong is right beside Marian Anderson. You know, Frank Zappa is right beside
ABBA. Or ABBA.
Yeah, there was a store actually in Toronto called From ABBA to Zappa, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there was. It used to be on Bathurst Street, Bathurst and DuPont. It was a small secondhand store. But even there, he actually broke it down so that it was into section, because I don't think he was selling anything by listing it from A to Z. But
anyway, not you.
Not me, not the way I think of it, because it's all music. That's all it is. There's good music and there's the other kind. But for me, because my taste is so varied anyway and always has been, and I think has been kind of eclectic, I don't want to define it as jazz or as one thing over another. Yes, the form might be jazz, and yes, I listen to a lot of jazz per se. But I listen to everything because I get something of value, depending upon my mood and my interest, out of a country record as much as I will from a 20th century music record or something by Frank.
Yeah, I wonder if that's a factor in Zappa's fans. They like
the eclectic taste
yeah.
that they have.
Yeah.
I think it is, particularly with the European fans.
Oh, yeah, right.
No question. I mean, one of the reasons why musicians succeeded more so in European fans is because they just have their arms are wider open to different types of music, and they seem to, European fans in particular, seem to embrace all forms of music with a great deal of enthusiasm.
Yeah.
Frank loved touring Europe because he felt that he could do more. I mean, certain musicians of a genre felt that they could do more and take more risks in performance anyway in Europe because they felt that it wouldn't be judged as harshly as it would be here.
Right. Okay, a side thing. Do you remember when Reagan went to Bitburg, I think in May 1985? Do you remember that controversy at CKLN? Do you remember?
I remember the music around it. In other words, there was an album or an EP or a single that came out. Who was it by? The Dead Kennedys?
Maybe, yeah.
Or something like that.
No, I'm
like
talking
that,
about
or,
the event itself. And
the event itself.
You know, John Jones, Anton Leo, everybody was a holy shit, Reagan's a Nazi. And see,
right.
I was at CKLN then, and I remember that.
Yes.
Then Zappa put out Reagan at Bitburg, but you were there at that
Reagan.
Time. Just wondering
yes.
if you picked up the same atmosphere I did about that news story.
Atmosphere
of
what?
The
shock.
People say, what? Why is Reagan going to honor Nazis in Bitburg?
Right.
I remember, you know, people at CKLN programmers talking about it. I'm just wondering if you experienced that there. Did you talk to anybody? Did you get outraged or did you even know about it?
I don't remember getting outraged by it. I guess I should have. I mean, Reagan...
You were too busy listening to Zappa to pay attention.
I was too busy listening to Zappa wrapped in my own world at the time.
Yeah.
What year was this again?
May 85, I think.
May of 85. So I just finished school, actually. I finished university, so I was working as a teaching assistant for my first year there. So I was more involved with the first-year students in the RTA program.
So you had already
left
CKLN?
No, I was still there. I didn't leave until 1986. But I know that there was a lot of controversy around that. I don't think I caught the heat of the controversy at the radio station, but perhaps you can refresh my memory.
Well, I just remember
talk about it.
People talking about it, and that was the atmosphere in the news department with Dave Neufeld and that, and
right.
that's the time I remember talking to you around that time at CKLN.
Oh, yes. Okay, is that when we've sort
of first
met, or?
I'm doing neurolinguistics. I'm trying to trigger a mood you might have experienced, put you right back in that time, but apparently it's the wrong one. You didn't...
I don't remember.
I
must have missed that meeting. Sorry. Not that I should have been, surprised at what happens with presidents who either lived in their own dream world. And by 1985, Reagan wasn't doing very well. Even he was quietly diagnosed with a mild form of dementia by that point.
Yeah.
Even though they kept it under wraps, right?
Yes. Now, here's something.
Anyway.
I don't know what you know about me in that period, but did you know that Zappa, when he went on September 19th, 1985, a few months later after Bitburg, to do his PMRC stick, did you know that he had phoned Mae Brussel, who we had featured on CKLN, who was the expert on the Nazi background to Reagan and those people, and also had a lot to say about Bitburg? Did you know that Zappa went and talked to her before he went to Washington?
No, I didn't know that at the time.
Do you remember us playing Mae Brussel? Did you ever hear that?
I remember Mae Brussel distinctly. She had a really interesting, did she put out like a weekly thing?
Yes,
weekly radio thing?
Yeah,
and
we used
reproduce
to play
that.
Yeah.
You used to play it. And of course, I remember hearing a lot of different things, but quite frankly, I did not have a sense of history at the time that would have really appreciated the connection she was making. That said, Frank obviously did. Do you believe that Frank was inspired by Mae, or did she help him turn the corner on certain issues?
Yeah, here was the sequence. I went to New York in August 1984. A week or two before or after the Pier concerts, which I also attended. But I went back a second time to go to the Limelight because my buddy Henry Greenbaum, my Zappa connection for bootlegs and everything was said that Frank is going to be at the Limelight. Come on down tonight. So I ran out to the airport and got there. So I started talking to him about Rebel Magazine and Larry Flint. And Mae Russell, he knew a bit about that because he had interacted with Larry Flint in September 83 over the downing of KAL 007.
Yes.
Okay, so I turned him on to Mae Russell, so I sent him the tapes. And then he played in Nova Scotia in November 84. So let me see. This is August 84. I sent him the – he's interested. He didn't know Mae Russell. By November 84, he's playing in Halifax. And I get to see him backstage, and I flew down to Halifax, and he complimented on this Mae Russell, but he didn't say much. He just said very interesting stuff. And then I get a call, you could say a year later, November 85, and Mae's telling me Frank called her before the Washington meetings to get the goods on those guys, just to see what she knew about them. So he was able to walk in confidently, knowing he got blackmailable information on him, at least what Mae had. Do you know what I mean? It made him feel protected, knowing the dirt about these different guys.
I see. Now, she lived in – did she live in California?
Yeah, Carmel, California.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, Clint Eastwood was her mayor.
That's her. Did she vote for him?
No, she was very controversial. I don't know if she what she said to him. I never talked to her much about it. But she was known because she was on the local radio, and she was a controversial person.
Yeah.
But anyways, the thing is that so she tells me, she's calling me to say, I knew that you had something to do with this. You know, she didn't know that I turned him on to her. He just called her up and asked some information, and she knew who he was. Mm-hmm. And now she's telling me November 85, guess what? He sent me a computer. That was his payment for the information. He gave her a brand-new computer, and that's early 1985 for people.
Oh, yeah. So yeah, they were really expensive in those days, too.
Right, and so then so you have Zappa. And then Bitburg comes out, and I said, wow, look at that. He's doing the Nazi thing, and and it's supplemented by his information he got from Mae Russell. So that's an interesting sidebar on that period. And you basically end with that. Let me see. Is that the last thing you do in the book in his career? Yeah, user discretion advised. Zappa and the politics of censorship. After that, it's yearbook signing, father and son. Yeah, that's the last Zappa mainstream media icon you deal with in his career.
Mm-hmm.
You do talk about the 88 tour. I mean, different places.
Yes.
And it's
Horribilis.
Do you know if that's the... Are you taking off on Annus Miraculous, 1922?
No, but that's a good reference. No, I was actually referring to that one came up because that was used by Queen Elizabeth.
Oh, yeah?
The second, when she made a public speech in, I guess it was 2002, and in 2002 she lost her sister and she lost her mother.
Yeah.
And she actually, the only personal reference she made was she used the words Annus Horribilis.
Ah, okay. Well,
and that's where I got that from.
All right. Well, it's in literature. They talk about, Eliot, Pound, and Joyce in 1922 put out a lot of stuff. Ulysses.
Yes. So that was a very good year. It was what year? 1922.
Yeah. And the critics called it the Annus Miraculous, I think it is. And it's miraculous. So I was wondering if you were bouncing off that. But no, you got it from the Queen. You're a good Canadian. No. You got it from the Queen,
man. Yes, I got it from the Queen. Sorry. My thinking doesn't go back to 1922. It goes back to 2002.
Yeah, that's good. So let's see. You have that quite earlier. Let's see how you're organizing this. You've got 1988 in chapter 25. Then you go into conceptual continuity, then 200 Motels, and then his video productions, then his TV appearances, and then you come back to his public performance at the Washington hearings, and that's the final thing. And that's, that is what people remember him for now, the younger people, right? He's the guy who they go on YouTube and they see him arguing with CNN and that and debating.
Oh, yeah.
That's something
yes, they do.
You know, younger people, I find they – they go to YouTube, you tell them about Zappa, they'll do it, and they go, geez, that guy is a pretty interesting talker. I find him very interesting. They respond to Zappa as a political talker. That's what they first experience.
Yeah, it's great.
And then they don't know about the music till later. But
indeed.
So you actually it's appropriate that you end with that image or that part of his career.
Well, thank you for that observation. I wanted to do more on the politics of that, but when you're writing a book and you're doing it for a major publisher such as Hal Leonard, you have to make a number of compromises along the way. There was more about his politics and how they informed his music, a lot more on that that I had originally pitched, but they were kind of shy about putting too much of that information in. So it's kind of ironic that actually you mentioned the fact that the YouTube appearances, which talk about politics and conservatism and all the rest of it, have actually appealed to so many young people.
Yeah, so your book is for young people. So your book publishers, they're obsolete. They're in the wrong. They don't understand the other media. They only know books, it seems. Yeah, so the very thing that you could have emphasized more, it would have been, these guys didn't understand that's what he was known for, as you get younger people.
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah, so it is refreshing to learn that you know, not so much me, but so much that people have actually tuned in, if you like, to a lot of Frank via YouTube.
There's this interview with, Alex Jones. Do you know who he is?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay,
I do.
He interviewed Gale Zappa, 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, I heard it somehow. And he was talking about, wow, your husband was an amazing guy. He was on all these issues that I go on about, 20, 30 years ago.
Right.
And he found that out by, going to YouTube and hearing Frank talk. That's how he found out. That was what Frank was to him, a great libertarian or something,
Yeah.
Against the establishment like Jones thinks he is. And
yes.
But there it is, the next generation. He is interviewing Gale about Frank on that level.
Wow.
Political level.
Yeah. How did that conversation go?
And thinking he's a role model. He's saying Frank's a role model for us. But the conversation Gale was, they liked each other, it seemed.
Oh, okay.
They went into, Gale didn't go into whether 9/11 was a government conspiracy or not, which, Jones is a leader of that kind of thinking.
Well, he is, although he's become very caustic over the years and much more of a paranoid person than he ever has before. I actually tuned him out many years ago.
Yes.
I had to. He was just too much.
I hate his voice, his growly voice. That's ridiculous.
It's a turnoff in and of itself, and he seems to feel that he has to equate rage, not anger, but rage with dissent. And it's like, no, you can be very calm and have a dissenting point of view. If you watch Frank, he's totally in control of what he's like, right?
Yeah, very detached.
And the irony is the fact that even Frank, as he's called himself many times, he's actually a conservative.
Yeah, yeah.
He doesn't believe in certain things regarding certain institutions and the way they operate, and he believes that, tax cuts were a good idea. Well, I guess at the time they were, and now they've become something else, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But, who knows what he would have thought now. But he certainly didn't trust politicians. He didn't trust too many institutions. He hated the education system, as you know.
Right. Well, he was known a bit by his peers back then in the 60s, 70s, as a conspiracy freak, because he talked about LSD as a CIA conspiracy.
Yes,
so those that weren't inclined to that kind of thinking put Frank down. Probably, I don't remember, Barry Miles probably did. I don't know if he did, but I have to go back and look at the book, but that's the kind of thing that Barry Miles would object to, it seemed. But here's the thing. People say, what would Frank compose today? What would he do? Well, one of the most interesting things would be him being interviewed by Alex Jones, and what would they agree and disagree on? What would Frank be prompted to scold Jones and his paranoia about? You know what I mean?
Indeed.
That would be interesting.
Yeah. That would be interesting.
Because, Jones is in the Zappa genre of being looking at conspiracies. Zappa started it within rock music, pop music, pretty well. What would he do with his progeny? What do you call it? His spawn, right? You spawn monsters, right? So he'd look at what happened to this conspiracy meme and what it is today. So I never thought of that before, but that would have been a tremendous dialogue. Not Gail, but Frank and Alex Jones.
Frank and Alex Jones, yeah. That would have been rather interesting. I think that Frank had, depending upon his mood, was had a healthy skepticism of just about everything.
Yeah, yeah.
And although he was kind of quick to judge on a few on certain circumstances, he usually was right.
Yeah.
He and this is something that, of course, only history can sort of put into perspective. You know, he's been gone for an awfully long time, and I can see why the things that he was saying, certainly about the religious right at the time, in those years, has a certain amount of appeal, because he was the only one that was sort of saying these things, or
yeah.
was able to at least put them together, or at least think about them.
He was saying it before these guys got into the White House with Reagan.
Oh, long before,
yeah.
You know. But he wasn't wrong, and I'm glad I was able to at least mention that in my book. I wanted to go into much more detail about that, but that's fine. You know, if people who read my book understand that this is where, even on a superficial level, understand where Frank was coming from, they can pursue more of it.
Yeah.
I mean, they can do their own research. One of the things that's been, it's a blessing as well as a curse, is the fact that the internet exists and all of these things are out there, and you have to dig deep and pull, you know, put your own Frank Zappa story together.
Well, that's part of the usefulness of your book. Since you update the last 20 years or so,
right.
Then I can go, I didn't know Chad Wackerman said that, and I can go look it up.
Yeah.
You're actually a trigger for internet exploring.
Well, that would be nice. I hope that would be the case.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's, you're saying that your editors chopped a lot out?
No, I wouldn't say they chopped a lot out. They just didn't want me to write about it in the first place. I had to put a formal proposal together that was in agreement with the FAQ series. And as you know, there are dozens of books, hundreds of books in the FAQ series, either in pop culture, television entertainment, and, you know, rock and roll music. And so I came in as not as part of that series, which meant that not so much a template had to be fulfilled, but the notion of individual chapters where people could jump in and jump out, where the narrative arc of the piece isn't the whole book, but each individual chapter. I had extra on the original pitch. I don't have. I'd have to look it up to see what I said, but I had more on about the. I had at least two solid chapters about the politics of Frank Zappa.
Right.
And I was only allowed to keep the one.
Who is this publisher? Are they Canadian?
No, it's American. Backbeat Books is an imprint of Hal Leonard, one of the most successful music publishers in the world.
Oh, I see.
Who put out music books, instructional music books and videos and things like that. And Backbeat Books is the company.
It's called Imprint?
It would be an imprint, if you like, or a subsidiary of Hal Leonard Incorporated.
Right.
Good people, good books. I had more of their music books than other books, it seems, in my collection of sheet music.
Would you have done a book on Zappa if this opportunity never came up?
No, probably not.
How did they find you?
It was a recommendation of Kevin Currier.
Who I'm going to ask you about. I was just going to bring him up. But yeah, go ahead.
Yeah.
So Kevin knew about them, knew their series.
Well, Kevin learned about them through my literary agent, whose name is Robert Lecker, who is based in Montreal. He used to own and operate ECW Press here in Toronto, sold his portion of that. One of the last things that when he was on board with ECW, it's still in existence on a smaller scale, before he sold his sort of ownership share and stayed in Montreal. He also teaches at McGill. He was publishing Kevin's book.
Okay.
The Dangerous Kitchen.
Right.
And so when this came up again through his connection, so he represents a number of authors in the FAQ series. And
did he ask Kevin to do one?
He asked Kevin to do one. Kevin says, no, I don't really have the time, and I've already written my book on Zappa, and he recommended me.
Okay. Now, let's go into that. I was going to ask you, you meet him, you get your Zappa affinity, you tell each other that in 1986. You become Zappa Brothers, you say.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
How did that happen? Was he a film critic at that point? At CBC?
Yes. He was also a producer at CJRT Radio, which was on Victoria Street, which was a private nonprofit radio service that was partially funded by the Ontario government for its educational, distance educational programming called Open College.
Yeah, it was CKLN before CKLN.
No,
right?
It wasn't. That was CKLN was separate. CKLN.
No, but wasn't Ryerson? Didn't Ryerson create CGRT? Didn't
they? Yes, they did. But it wasn't. It wasn't CKLN. That came later. But CJRM before.
So they left
CGRT
Ryerson
formally.
And became
they
private.
They left and they became a private nonprofit with an affiliation with Ryerson, i.e., the building that they were in, they leased from Ryerson proper.
Right.
And that they were also got a component of funding on an annual basis from the Ontario government through the Ministry of Education, actually.
Right.
And then they also had to fundraise on their own, plus very limited commercial and private sponsorships. It was basically done on a shoestring budget, but that's where Kevin worked.
Yeah.
And he worked for the program called On the Arts, which was on 3 days a week with the late Tom Fulton. And that's where he sort of honed his crafts, not only as an interviewer, but certainly as someone who was extremely smart and sharp and was able to learn how to talk about literature and film, especially, on a higher level, even though it was in pop culture, but to discern, to get beyond the kind of consumer-friendly aspect of popular culture and to move into something much deeper.
Did he eventually get on CBC?
Yes.
Yeah, I thought that's what was in my mind. He got to, but he started at CGRT. Okay.
That's correct.
So you meet him in 86. Brought the Zappa point up? You heard him talking about Zappa? Or?
Wow, that's a good question. I guess as we got to know one another through the service and our love of music, Zappa must have come up.
Maybe he was at the store. Maybe he came into the store one day.
Well, yeah, that would have been around, but that was a little later. That was a little later. And so he was writing, it's all a bit blurry now, sorry, but I'm sure we had a conversation about Zappa in the 90s, or shortly after we had met, and it was either...
Well, you became Zappa Brothers in 86.
Yes. That's right. That's when we first met. What I call is Zappa Brothers because...
Zappa didn't come up right away.
Didn't come up right away.
I see.
But that through our love of Frank Zappa, which once we had sort of converted that, when he started working on his book back in 1998,
right.
Then it sort of that connection became fused and became much much deeper. And then the next thing we were in touch, certainly. I can remember when Frank died, he and I talked about that.
Yeah.
No question.
So did he read this manuscript before you sent it in?
He read, he helped me out with certain chapters of it, not the whole thing. I shared a few chapters with my sister-in-law, who is a high school teacher.
Yeah.
And the reason I shared them with her, because she knew nothing about him.
Yes.
So I bounced a couple of the early chapters off of her to see if they all made sense. One of the things that happens when you go to school, and I know you know this, Bob, is that certain teachers leave you with an impression.
Yep.
And one of the teachers that I had at Ryerson left me with the impression that I couldn't write to save my life, that I had bad syntax problems and all the rest of it, right? So I've become ultra-conscious ever since that day of making sure that my syntax, grammar,
right,
and whatnot is correct. So I bounced those chapters off of her. I gave because I wanted this to be my book, and he was very busy at the time as well. But the fact of the matter is that he helped me with the original pitch. I bounced the original pitch off him, and I said, "Does this cover all of the areas that we need to cover for a book of this nature?" And he said, "Yes, I'd love it." So his input was really, really at the very, very beginning, and on the chapter, particularly on conceptual continuity.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did I get that? Did I explain it in a way that would appeal or at least be understood by someone who didn't really understand it So that particular chapter, in this case, I guess chapter 26, I bounced off him the first draft of that.
Right.
And then he made some changes, not too many, but he said, yeah, this makes sense. This is clear. And if it was clear to him, as my soul, I know I should have consulted you, Bob, but answer then. But the
know.
Fact, I mean, I didn't know. But he was my Zappa scholar.
Right.
You know, and he still is, really.
So do you ever talk with him about motifs, that interpretation of conceptual continuity? Do you ever say, hey, look at this, he does this there, and it shows up over there? Did you ever do that?
No, we never really did. We not in specific terms, no.
Do you listen to Scott Parker and Andrew Greenaway's radio blog? Or
no, I do have Scott...
his books.
His book, which
yeah.
was a kind of a self-published thing, but proved to be invaluable to me when it came out
right.
at a time when I was right in the middle of writing and trying to get all that stuff together regarding his recordings.
Okay, another topic. I was surprised that you hadn't read David Wally's book. I think you said you couldn't get it.
I couldn't get it. Yeah, that's right.
You know, do you know...
And what was that book? That was from 1971, and that
yeah.
was one of the first books...
No Commercial Potential.
No Commercial Potential, yes.
It was the first... Matter of fact, he was written up in New York Times when he died back in, you know, 5-10 years ago, and...
Oh, yeah.
He,
did they mention that book?
Yes, but they... That book was the first book on a rock star, not counting the... whatever those books were on the Beatles that came out maybe around
Oh,
there.
Really?
Yeah, it's
really, which were
first.
Written... Those books by on the Beatles were probably written by publicists anyway.
Right. So
yeah.
they say... I didn't know this till, you know, I found out about it when he told me, but
right.
I didn't know that it was considered the first. I thought there were books out about, I don't know, Led Zeppelin or something in 70, 71 or
yeah, you'd think
the
so.
Beach Boys, but it's considered the first one. And you know the trouble he had with Frank over that. You don't know, you're not
getting
aware
his cooperate. No, I'm sorry, I don't.
Yeah, well,
did he have trouble getting cooperation from Frank at the time or
no, he let's see. I knew Dave Wally because I knew the East Village Other, and he wrote for the East Village Other, and he wrote for Jazz and Pop. So I met him in New York in 1970. So I go to New York in November of 71 to see the premiere for 200 Motels. So I stay with him, and he's telling me the problem he has with Frank. And I had visited Beefheart in the summer of 71 in Ben Lomond. And when I told him Dave Wally was doing a book on Zappa, he got outraged. This is when he had gotten mad at Frank in 71. He didn't like the promotion of the Bizarre albums and all that. You know that story? The
oh, yeah. You mean Beefheart didn't like that?
Yeah, Beefheart didn't like was mad at Frank. So
yeah, yeah.
He goes,
yeah.
He says to me, and I didn't expect this. He says, "What do you mean this guy's doing a book with Frank? He's not worth doing a book. He's at best a good engineer, but what?"
Well,
and he says, "Let me talk to this guy." So I gave him Dave Wally's number, and of course Wally has Beefheart in the book, so it helped expand who he could have. I don't know if he had access to Beefheart, but I knew Don, so we connected up. But that's in the summer of 71, and then so I'm at David's place in November 71, and he gets me to read the manuscript. He says, "I've had a real falling out with Frank over the last few months. Frank didn't like it, started to not sort of cooperate with it. He had done stuff with Frank and made the basic manuscript. Now Frank was objecting to it, and it became a big emotional problem for David, and Frank started saying in interviews later that David Wally, he regards me as his psychiatrist. I'm not here for therapy." So they had a real falling out, and it really embarrassed Dave. But he carried on. He had his own career in New York anyways, and he did other books. But it was always a problem, this tension between them. So when he did the reissue or update in 1980, it's skimpy when he does the 70s because he's not following Frank that closely. And then he does another update in 1990, I think. Meanwhile, when Nigel Lennon's book came out, which was 95 or so, they bonded. And one day, Wally was listening to old tapes of him at Zappa's home interviewing Zappa for the book back in 70, 71. And there, and when Nigel's book came out, some people said, "No, she's making this up. Well, there's no proof that she was with Frank." Well, he is listening to an old interview, and in the interview, a young woman comes in and starts talking to Frank and it's Nige. And Dave has it on his tape. So he knew she was a Mr. DeFrank.
She was there. Yeah.
Yeah, because he had it on tape. He didn't know really who she was at that moment. But she was part of the environment when she was interviewing Zappa, and so that confirmed that. So he supported Nige, and they became good friends.
Good.
Let's see. Why am I bringing this up? So the book is pretty good about time and non-time. I mean, the basic outline, you don't see people talk about it too much. Watson probably does, but I don't see people get into the abstract sociological level that Wally was doing, because he was trained as a culture historian, I think, at Yale. So he had a good college-educated view of things, and but he lived, he slummed it in the East Village. So if you haven't read that book, it must be available somehow in a used bookstore.
You never know. Well, you know, what I got to do is look for it.
Yeah.
See if I can track a copy down. I'll try to, I'll try to get any version I can. Sure.
Many books have come since then, but, you know, Ben Watson's is probably the most intellectually sophisticated book.
Indeed.
But as Kevin told me, Ben doesn't know American culture because he didn't grow up in it. He grew up in England. And so there's a big disconnect, Kevin said. And and when I told him, well, I think McLuhan would be better to explain Frank or to fit him into some intellectual framework. And he goes, wow, do it, Bob, do it.
Yes.
You know, do the McLuhan thing. So I eventually did it on this series I'm doing. But Ben and I did a 36 hours on Renaissance Radio, FM, Renaissance FM in London, and that's an argument between the Marxist, the educated, sophisticated Marxist view versus the McLuhan view. So our debate is right there on the record that we did for 36 hours. The spelling out of the McLuhan points haven't been done in book form, which I haven't done, but I did it in dialogue with some Zappa scholars. One of them is a student of Stockhausen in Berlin.
A
student of Stockhausen. She has a lot of interesting things to say. So so I'm bringing up Dave Wally as the beginning book that you weren't aware of or haven't read.
No.
Do you disagree with those that say Ben's book is irrelevant? It's total fantasy?
No.
You don't agree
with
that?
No, and that's the kind of the first that I've heard it. I think anybody... I mean,
he said he had a lot of flack on.
Oh, I'm sure he did.
Frank Zappa.
Well, of course. I mean, there is the Frank Zappa that we all know and love. And the interesting thing, and for better or worse, is that we each have our own individual relationship with Frank Zappa, his music, and of course, I mean, you and I have had particular insights. You on a more personal basis. Me as a subject for a book.
Yeah.
And then that relationship is ours. Like, it can't really be reproduced in any other way. So anybody who dismisses Ben Watson's book as saying that it's irrelevant is actually missing the point.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, Ben doesn't think it's irrelevant. Frank didn't think that Ben was irrelevant.
Right.
There are certain parts of the book that my eyes start to gloss over because it's simply... I'm not that sharp, or I don't think his writing is that engaging. It becomes a little too obtuse, a little too philosophical.
Yeah,
you know, I don't dismiss the work. I just find that you have to be prepared to read. I mean, I read his book. I had to read his book, or at least be familiar with the gist of what he said on a lot of stuff, because there's a lot of value in that. Anybody who dismisses it outright as being irrelevant is missing the point. If you think that book is irrelevant, then write your own.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And Ben's thesis, he says, as a consumer of Zappa, I have the right to make my own universe out of what I think Frank's about.
Exactly.
And he says, that's what I'm doing. I'm just telling you what I get from it. And it's very good on that level because he has many ideas and refers it to his sophisticated Cambridge education. He knows about Finnegan's Wake, Wyndham Lewis, and all these things that I know about that makes it interesting. He broadens the context. And probably for the average only semi-educated American, that's too encyclopedic. It's too beyond what they think of Frank as.
Exactly. I mean, this is I mean, this is one of the interesting things that Frank sort of said about himself. He didn't want to have a legacy. He didn't really want to be remembered.
Yeah.
And of course, well, I'm sorry, Frank, but that's not up to you. We're going to remember you whether you like it or not. But the fact of the matter is, I don't think the reason Frank didn't want to say that, or the reason he did say that, is because I guess. At the end of the day, he didn't feel what he was doing was only important to him and to nobody else. Of course, he was, you know, unfortunately, he was wrong. But that's fine.
Well, he did. Let me tell you this. I just saw this recently.
Yeah.
Says maybe it's in Eat That Question.
Yes.
He says people who want to be remembered. That's guys like Bush and Reagan who build these ridiculous libraries. So he was trying to be. You know, I don't want to the icon or the cliche about being remembered had been altered by recent people, and so he felt, well, I don't want to be like that kind of person. So,
no.
But it was unique for an artist to say, I don't want to be remembered, because it is a big cliche that most artists are trying to be remembered since printing press, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So I consider it an original approach, him doing
it. Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, I mean, he may not have sincerely believed it, but it was a good thing to say. Hey, I don't even want to be remembered. That's pretty good. He stands out as he always did.
He's still, exactly. He's still taking that.
That's how he got remembered. It's so radical to say that. That's how he got remembered. He's
that's
the guy
exactly
that says
how
he
got remembered. Yeah. Oh, I don't want to be remembered. Okay.
I will remember you, despite you.
Yeah, that's right.
So,
exactly.
Okay, now let's go to another thing. What do you regret, resent the way Gail handled the project once Frank was gone? Are you pro-Gail or indifferent or anti-Gail?
I'm trying to remain neutral on it. I don't know her personally and all the rest of it. So my position is that on the one hand, it's kind of ironic that Frank, in fact, told her while he was still alive that she should get out of the business altogether.
Right.
Yet she insisted on staying in the business. So was that the right choice?
Right.
Well, in retrospect, at the time, probably not. But in retrospect, absolutely necessary. Right?
Yeah.
But so I think that her involvement, although it's a little too hands-on for my good, and I know that Dweezil has said this publicly, is that she kind of misunderstood the notion of having Frank's music played everywhere. It was actually to the benefit of Zappa's musical legacy and his artistry, not to the detriment of his musical legacy and the fact that you're not getting paid for it and stuff like that.
And that they may not be perfect in their execution of it.
That's right. I mean, yeah, the human element was always there. So she wasn't forgiving enough. And I certainly know that many members, especially Jimmy Carl Black, didn't like her at all because she was just too controlling on a lot of different things, right?
Yeah.
And that, I get it. I get that. But I don't regret the things that she did or whatever.
Do you know Massimo Bozzoli? You ever heard of Massimo Bozzoli, the Italian journalist in the Dubroom special?
Oh, yeah.
Tingy.
Go on.
What's the song? Tingy, yingy, some kind of weird thing. He's eating bun.
Yeah.
So that guy is a longtime good friend of Gail, and I met he and Gail in a year before, actually exactly October 6th and 7th, 2014, at the Marin County Festival premiere of Sicily 1982, whatever that was called, that documentary, which is really good. You know, it's about Zappa and the cover of The Man from Utopia with the riot.
In
his hometown in Palermo, Sicily.
And that's a documentary.
Yeah, really good. I guess, it's amazing you haven't heard of it.
I hadn't heard of that. Sorry, no.
Yeah, Google that. It's not. I guess it hasn't got shown around yet.
Maybe,
That question kind of took it over.
Got
more publicity. But
yes, sir, did.
He told me when I was with her, and I didn't know it. He probably knew it, that Gail was sick. This is a year before she died.
Sure.
But he said, I think Gail really handled the state well. She knows what she's doing, and he really, you know, you wouldn't bring up any objections around him. Punch you out probably, but he was very confident in what and understood what Gail had done. So there are some people who really think she did it, and you're saying that in retrospect she was smart what she did, and I guess in protecting.
In retrospect, a bit, but not perfect.
Yeah,
not perfect. Nevertheless,
but definite grievance about the holding being too much of a purist for Zappa being played by people.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's Gail. Do you have anything to say about the argument among the kids right now?
Well, it's very sad that the result of her kind of decision that she made quite literally on her deathbed to divvy up the trust in that way as has been openly discussed, unfortunately. First of all, this is sort of, the Zappa family hanging out their dirty laundry and all of this. And that's very disappointing, actually, because it's really, at the end of the day, it's none of our business, but they made it our business. So what are we supposed to do? Here we are on a telephone line now having a conversation about it. And I think that, I'm just disappointed with it. How it's going to end, I don't know.
Have you heard any new things? Has anything come out the last couple
of
months?
The only thing new I've heard is that Dweezil's campaign to raise funds regarding his what looks to be either a countersuit or something or an illegal objection against the trademark of the name Zappa.
Yeah.
Is still going ahead, and where it goes after that, I don't know.
Okay. Because the other thing is, I found this on YouTube at some point recently, that he allowed Ike Willis to play with him.
Yes.
Which is a big deal because, I talked to Ike for years about the problem between him and Gail and the hassle they have.
Yeah.
That really shows Dweezil has defected from the Gail point of view to actually bring Ike onto the stage with him.
I guess so, but I would hope that it was only in the service of the music.
Yeah. No, and also... Well, I think I have to talk to Ike about it, but I haven't done that yet. But it's I think it's the Dweezil. You read in your book. Yeah, here's that incredible quote. They're all disgusting. All these cover bands. Remember the quote you have?
Yep.
Well,
yep.
That's a long time ago.
And
that's Dweezil under the influence of Gail, I think.
Probably.
Now he had to. I think he's realized, hey, I got to make up for that. I'm not under Gail's opinion so much now. And so I can acknowledge people like Ike Willis, apologize to them.
Yes.
So I'll find out from Ike what has actually happened. Because actually about a year ago I asked him, I said, I'm not sure. I said, well, now that Gail's gone, do you feel that you got more leeway? He said, no, they're still hassling me. And I don't know who he said was. Do you know what I mean? I don't know if he said Dweezil. So, but that was a year ago. Now it's different. I mean, at least Ike has got Dweezil on his side.
Right.
He's good.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so let's see. What other, back to your book. What kind of review? I have not read any reviews. If you know where they are, send me some links. But what?
Some of them are on my website. There are links to a couple of things. Yes.
Okay, so what are they what are they saying generally about your book?
Well, whenever you write it, I certainly knew going in that by writing a book about Frank Zappa, I had to make sure that I pleased myself first, and then let the chips fall where they may, knowing that many of the hardcore Zappa freaks, the United Mutations fans and all of that, would be very tough on it. In other words, they're going to be looking for certain information and details that has to be spot on.
Yeah.
And on the facts anyway. And so the reviews that I have been getting, so whenever I'm most pleased is that they say that it's been well written. Well, there you go. I've done my job.
You said that to your professor.
They've said to that, and that's
right.
That's right. Yes. I said, I should. Well, she's probably no longer alive.
Okay.
Anyway, but the fact is, that was a long time ago. But the fact that it's well written is one of the common threads.
There are a couple little mistakes.
There are mistakes in it. Yeah, I knew. They don't go on about that. The only I'm grateful for, because once it's published, and we do our very best, not just me but my two editors, to go through everything and make sure that it's all as accurate as possible. But in the process of writing this book, which I was doing on a part-time basis, some days my mind wasn't that sharp, and sometimes I would repeat myself, or sometimes I would confuse certain people, and put that into the mix. And that's my own fault, and I accept responsibility for that. But the reviews have only pointed out a few factual errors, and rightly so, that's fine. But they haven't been so bad as to say that do not pick up this book or
right.
do not think in terms of this book as something that is not beneficial to the number of books out there. Like yourself, it's the first new book in many, years. Not too many years, but it's the first one about the big picture of Frank Zappa as opposed to Greenaway's book about the 88 tour, which is actually recent, and then these academic studies such as the
and
jazz
Zappa and
that long series of long-winded essays. But anyway, so I mean, it's all part of that. But most
nobody
people
seeing your book as redundant.
Nobody is saying it's redundant. Yeah. I can say that I was in touch with Frank's brother Bob through part of this process. The book had sort of been finished by the time his came out, so I had to lift his information from radio interviews that he did.
Yeah.
But he was very pleased with it, and that's enough for me.
Yeah.
And he also sent him a copy. And he sent a copy to his son, who is actually a working musician of some sort in Vancouver.
Hmm.
So I haven't heard from them or either. I haven't heard from anybody who is other than yourself in the book or as a follow-up, other than friends and family and people like that who do love it. And that's what they tell me, because I think for a lot of people, he's still, you know, as I say in the introduction, a bit of a mystery.
Yeah,
and
he's too big. They don't know what
he is too big. He is too big, and for people to come into his work now, and if I've been able to do that, then that's the success in and of itself.
Right, that's good. You know? So you haven't heard from Pauline Butcher?
No, I tried to get... I reached out to Pauline Butcher to get permission to use certain segments, and there was a huge confusion as to what her publisher was telling me and what she was telling me and what she was telling her publisher. So I needed to get permission to go ahead to use certain number of excerpts from her book, and her book is great. I really like that one. I drew a lot from that. I drew a lot from... Kevin's book, and of course Ben Watson's two books actually, and then the Miles book, and Cosmic Debris, and a few other things, you know, that just to get the story right, as well as Greenaway's book, and that. But then, you know, after a certain point, I kind of ran out of time, and I had to get to the writing process, you know.
Yeah.
And so there were very valuable websites that sort of pulled a lot of stuff together for me as well out of the magazine articles that were absolutely invaluable.
Right. So let's look at Pauline Butcher. It's surprising how good a book or the effect of it is, isn't it? It's a great book for filling.
Well, and Kevin got me onto that book. But the notion was the fact that who knew that he had a secretary? And number one, who knew that he had a secretary who was this sharp and could talk to him about so many different things about his work? And then to at least at the time put together her own diaries and her own letters that she basically wrote her mother to with, and then put them together in a book. I kind of wonder why it took so long. Because he's been gone for so long, but the fact of the matter is, that's sometimes that kind of 20 years of perspective actually gains you more momentum than at the time, because you have you're a little further away from your subject and your emotional connection to it, so you can actually write about it. And I think what was interesting about Pauline's book was just to get what she does best is what it was kind of like just to be around the house back in the late 60s. When so much was going on, and to gain some personal insight into some of the musicians, the original mothers of invention,
what happened among them, the feeling that got alienated there.
Yes.
Yeah, so
really valuable.
That's inside stuff. And then also her role in creating the GTOs was pretty interesting.
Yeah, very interesting, and how she became – very close to them.
Yeah.
That kind of insight is absolutely invaluable, because she bore witness. Right? Yeah. She was an eyewitness to all of that.
This is when, you know, when someone is big right at the beginning, often the average consumer doesn't know what's going on because they get suddenly put into a bubble. So Frank,
right.
I mean, Frank was nominated for this and that in 68, 69. Right in that period at the when he's at the log cabin before he moved to Woodrow Wilson Drive,
right.
That's when Frank was really a big name or the last word or this and that. It really was having an impact. And
you're
nobody
right.
knew, and everybody who was interested in him wanted to know, what was he doing back at home? You know, what was going on with his family or the GTOs? And there was no record of that. And that's what her book is. It fills in that period when he actually is
you're
famous,
right.
you know, and,
yes.
and a big deal for a few
yes.
years. And
yes.
that's when nobody could get to him. Most
Indeed.
People. They couldn't find
Indeed.
Out what he was doing.
Indeed,
they...
because, yeah, that's true. He was kind of more a little mistrustful of the press and stuff like that. And I think he was far more, I know he was a kind of a cynical man anyway, but I think he was more cynical when he was younger.
yeah, he became mellowed in many
he
ways.
Mellowed, yes,
yeah.
He did mellow, and he began, you know, he changed.
Yeah.
He changed, which was, he was still Frank, but, you know, he changed. And he wasn't this kind of edgy, I think he was much edgier when he was younger.
Yeah.
You know, and I think he probably felt that he had to be.
Well, a friend of mine who went on to be a filmmaker in Toronto, when he saw Zappa and knew of him, he saw him at the new Penelope, I think it was called, Montreal in 67 when Zappa first got there, 67, 68.
Yes.
And it was a big deal locally, you know, this strange character, these people
yeah.
come into town and
yeah.
the news covered them. And he sort of looking at him and looking at the album covers, Absolutely Free. And that, he said, I thought this guy was the Antichrist.
Oh,
that's how
goodness.
Powerful his image was, how
yes.
striking he was. Not that
yes.
Don was a fundamentalist or anything, but
no,
that
no.
He said there was something like, "Ooh, what is this guy? He's too detached.
Yes.
He's too beyond the normal thing, and he's managed to get into the mainstream. How did he do it?" And so he thought that. And, you know, remember there was a movie in 68 called Wild in the Streets, I think, about
oh,
this
yeah.
leader, this young guy taking over America and killing everybody over 30 and starting
right.
a youth America.
Right.
I think some people thought Frank might have been that kind of character in the paranoia of 67, 68.
Right.
When the
yeah.
counterculture was just starting to become an issue.
Right.
There was Frank in the middle of it. And then people might be surprised to go back and read interviews with him. No, he was actually, he thought it was all stupid. You know, he says, I don't want any more psychedelic like shows or any of those things. He
no,
even put them down.
Yes, he did.
And everybody, so here he was an icon in the mainstream, you know, Pat Buchanan world. And yet
right.
he was not, that was not his role. He felt he was different from all that.
Indeed.
A warning
yes.
about it. You know
yes.
what's interesting is Michael Gray's book, which has the manuscript from Pamela's Rubica.
Mm-hmm.
Have
mm-hmm.
you read that? The excerpt.
No.
Oh man, you got to read what Pamela was doing with Frank and what happened to him. And she tells us, you know, Michael was a friend of hers, so she allowed her manuscript parts of it to be in his book. So she talks about when they first go to England in 67, September 67, you know, that's when she's sort of being Susie Cream Cheese for the press.
Yes, yes.
And the excitement about Frank in that trip in London, she describes that night Frank was in bed and he was curled up in a fetus position and shaking. He actually was afraid of the notoriety or whatever fame he was getting. And she says that she told him, he was starting to think, I don't know what to say. I don't know what to do about this. I'm becoming a leader image, and I don't want to do that. And
right.
she says, no fucking way do you give up. I quit college. I became a follower of what you're doing. This is back in the freakout days of 65, 66. She says, I've sacrificed myself to help your movement. You're not backing out. And so she describes this crisis that Frank had, which no one would know unless they read
unless you were there. And what? That's Michael Gray's book?
Yeah, I think it's G-R-A-Y or E-Y. Michael Gray, mid-80s. Now, shortly after that, the mystery boxes, what were they called? The mystery disc came out?
Yep.
And he had a booklet. And if you notice, there's an X through Pamela Rubica's image.
Yeah.
He got mad, I think, about that book and her having that released. I don't know, but that's what might think why they X'd her out. You know what happened to her?
Pam.
Zarupa got. Do you know anything about her? No, I'm asking. I know. Do you know what I'm going to tell you? Have you been up on her?
Not lately.
Yeah, well, she's a medium in London.
She's a medium?
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Do you remember, what was it called, Simon Prentice's newsletter 3 or 4 years ago? Rune Punti. Who's the weird monster guy in the movies? Rune. I can't remember. Rune Toon, maybe you don't know.
No, sorry.
There was this actor. He played the monster evil guys.
Oh.
And Simon Prentice named his newsletter after that. I'll have to Google it maybe in a minute. But anyways, there's an article by Pamela in there, or an interview with her. I'll have to send you the link if you haven't seen. It's
I have no idea.
Simon attempting to get a newsletter or intellectual journal going on about Zappa, and only lasted a few years.
Oh, I see.
No, I'm not going to.
She's in London, UK.
Yeah. So anyway, she's around, and I don't know if she'll talk much about Frank, but she does do. I don't know what she makes of the falling out they had, but she does say something in this article on her in Prince's newsletter, so which is an online thing.
Right.
So I'm asking about. Michael Gray's book, so you might want to check that out. And then,
yes, Mother, is the story of.
You're looking it up, eh?
Well, I just actually had a chance to be on AFCA.net, where he's got the books listed, and so now I see he's done a great job of listing that particular book. Yeah, from 1984.
Right,
Mother. It's the story of Frank Zappa. Yeah, it's on Proteus Books. It's probably still around. The first version of the book was published in 1984 and translated into Italian.
Here's the name of the, you can look this up. It's called the Rondo Hatton, H-A-T-T-O-N, the Rondo Hatton Report. And it says AFCA.net. Aren't you on AFCA?
I'm on AFCA, yes.
Yeah, put in R-O-N-D-O-H-A-T-T-O-N. It's a name that's said somewhere in Frank's music. Rondo Hatton.
R-O-N-D-O. O.
And then second
word,
H-A-T-T-O-N.
The Rondo Hatton Report.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, I see. Goes back to, that's actually recent. Well, recent as opposed to. The Return of Rondo Hatton, the recordings of Frank Zappa. They're doing an interview. Who is Rondo Hatton? You've introduced yourself as Rondo. A character actor from the old movies.
Yeah, here's what it says on the wiki.
From
American
King
soldier.
Kong?
Journalist.
Oh, an American soldier.
And journalist and an actor with a minor career playing thuggish bit and extra parts in Hollywood B-movies.
Ah.
Culminating in his elevation to horror movie star status with Universal Studios in the last 2 years of his life. Which would be 45, 46, and posthumously as a movie called Icon. He was known for his unique facial features, which were the result of acromegaly, a syndrome caused by a disorder of the pituitary gland. Acromegaly or something. So he was huge. He was born in Hagerstown, Maryland, to Missouri-born teachers. So you didn't know about him. You had not seen his movies.
Well, I bet you I would know him now if I saw
him.
Yeah,
you'd recognize him. Because,
I would probably recognize him
so
in
that,
some shapes, yeah.
So the whole thing about being ugly, you know,
right.
is what Simon adopts for the theme of the report. But there's a lot of good articles in there by Zappa fans.
Cool.
Yeah, to check that out.
Cool.
Let's see. Now, we did Pamela's Rubik. Okay, do you know about Lorraine Belcher?
She was one of his girlfriends.
Yes, she was the one busted with him at the porn thing in
March. That's right. Yes. Yeah. Back at Club Z, or rather Studio Z.
Studio Z, right?
That's correct. Yes, she was. She was let go, and then he was. I don't even think she was fined after that.
Right.
And he was fined and.
Well, guess what?
10 days.
Yeah, Google her and read an interview somebody did a few years ago. But this is another example of the spread of Frank. So Frank splits from her. So mm-hmm. she goes on and ends up being the wife or mistress of John Chamberlain, I think his name is, famous American sculptor.
Really?
And so she's in the art world for many years. Huh. And at the same time, she's also living at Frank's house in between there somehow. She's a mistress of Frank back in the 70s or 80s.
Yes.
And then she is now with the famous underground comic guy, S. Clay Wilson, I think. And so she's taking care of him. He's dying or sick or something.
Right.
But here's this woman. She's just a little kid in the boondocks in Cucamonga.
Yeah.
And then she ends up being very involved with the greatest musician and then the greatest sculptor, pretty significant sculptor, whatever Chamberlain does, and then with a major comic book guy. I mean, that is quite a story, this woman with three major artists.
Indeed.
And that comes from, I think I've seen a picture of her outside the studio with a baby or something. Do you remember that picture? It shows
no, I don't.
Some book shows a picture of the people hanging out with Frank at the studio. But there's another person who has a lot to say, I bet. I mean, she could, Frank could be considered a cartoonist. He could be, he's talking about doing a sculpture.
Yes.
All this mixed media stuff, she was a person in the middle of all of them, all of the top people. So people, if they're listening to this now, go call her up. Let's have some more interviews with her. She might have some interesting stories to tell.
She might have some stories, if she can remember.
Yeah, if she can remember.
Yeah, or as we get on, indeed.
So
where is she based now? She's based in where? In
I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe New York, maybe back in L.A. I don't know. Right. Maybe if S. Clay Wilson, he was a San Francisco guy. Maybe she's in San Francisco then.
Oh.
I can look that up.
Yes.
So let me see. What other things is there to say about your book? Did we do enough in the conceptual continuity? You've got the motifs. Mm-hmm. You've got the fact it's just him. You got the fact that he kept going. You got him being a physicist or thinking about science issues.
Yeah.
Also running for politician.
Yeah.
Since John Cage made speaking sort of acceptable, or silence and environmental sounds in as acceptable as part of the genre of composing, serious composing. And Zappa is not that clear how much he's influenced by Cage, but one or two places he names Cage.
That's
but
correct.
He always mentions the other guys more prominently. But what Zappa did is he took the meaning of Cage's idea and applied it, comprehensively, so that doing interviews or running, he says somewhere, running for president, he would consider a composition.
Hmm.
So he includes all creative activities, all activities, as part of the artistic act. And that could be developed because that's very similar to McLuhan's view.
Mm-hmm.
McLuhan considered the word media anything uttered or made by humans. That broad definition is what McLuhan meant by media. Zappa does the same thing with the word music. When he ends that information is not knowledge, and he says music is the best, what is music? Since it includes in that poem, information, beauty, wisdom, love, everything is not music, but then music is the best.
Mm. Yes.
Or music, how it goes, information, not knowledge, something's not this. He doesn't say it's all of it's not music, but he says music is the best. So how does music go beyond love, beauty, knowledge, information, and all the things he talks about in that I call a short poem. What does music mean? So we ask him in the Zappa interview that we do. I can't remember his answer. Let's look it up. That's what I open with that. Here's Zappa, the interview. So it opens. Let's just see. This might be it. It begins with Bob Marshall asking, in your mini manifesto on Joe's Garage, where you say information is not knowledge, knowledge is not wisdom, and at the end you say, music is the best. What is music? And he says, well, in the terms, I would use two different definitions for it, one in the clinical sense and one in the sense that applies to that little statement on the album. In the sense of the statement on the album, it would mean whatever you happen to think music is. That's a statement to other people. That's a statement to other people, and they would plug into that statement their concept of what music is. Mm-hmm. I'll recite it for you just for the people who don't have the album. So he recites it.
Right.
Then he says, so you get to figure out what your idea of music is and plug into that. Now, you were saying that earlier in terms of being a fan. You know, you can't judge someone's interpretation or use of Frank, and therefore the way Ben uses it is not erroneous. That's what Ben does with it. So Frank is agreeing with that here. But isn't it interesting that he is not, you know, specializing in what music is?
Yes, and because I think his it would have probably contradicted everything that he was about as a composer by freeing himself of any clear definition. And then maybe being a little vague on the answer is actually for his own protection, maybe, as an artist. I've read a lot about artists, and I often listen to interviews, and depending upon what that artist is doing, either a filmmaker or a sculptor or a painter or whatever, I think what's consistent when they talk about themselves in not so much their work, but just as a concept, art as a concept or music as a concept, they try to be vague because it frees. They don't want to have any kind of conclusive answer to that. It's actually better for certain composers not to have that question answered.
Yeah.
Because by seeking that answer out through their art, they're actually able to create more art, right?
Yeah,
and then that connection for them allow you know, if you want to call it a connection or non-connection, if you like, to a defined definition or a defined notion of what music is, would actually begin to close the door.
Right, but, it's like Miles Davis objecting to the concept jazz.
Actually hated it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He actually hated the name.
Right.
And a lot of jazz musicians in the time hated to use it. It's just music, you know.
Yeah.
What I mean,
yeah.
Ellington felt that way.
Yeah.
And it's like these are kind of definitions that are imposed by people who either aren't musicians or artists per se, or they're critics.
Yeah.
Or they are simply people who are just not comfortable with the notion of having their interests and their ideas undefined. I mean, it's out of their comfort zone to think and envision, well, yeah, music is the best, and all these other things are not really what they appear to be. Well, you're messing with people's very values and their value systems, right, ultimately?
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're getting into that core of their humanity that they may not want to go. And I think that what art does and what artists try to do is make us feel uncomfortable, right?
Yep.
I mean, that's why we love them.
That's
because
McLuhan,
they do.
McLuhan said they're anti-environmental. You know, people are dulled by habit and routine but into cliche situations and attitudes.
Right.
That needs to be shaken up.
Yes, and artists allow us to do that, allow humanity to carry on, allow humanity to question what it is they're doing here each and every day. Loosen them up, yeah. I mean, this is one of the reasons why why I love Leonard Cohen is because he was a guy that would just loosen us up.
Yeah, yeah.
And he would get right to the point. Louis Armstrong solos get right to the point because he doesn't want to crowd. He doesn't want to get there. He wants to make a point, but he also wants to get to the point. He wants to shake us of our notions of what's expected.
Right.
And to create things that are unexpected. And Zappa's music, if nothing else, it was unexpected when it first showed up, and it's still unexpected after his death.
That's right. So right. Two resonances. Did you know that Duke Ellington? Okay, Zappa can be seen as the second half of the 20th century Duke Ellington, redoing Duke Ellington, right, in the rock world as opposed to the jazz
sure.
world. So he's a Duke Ellington of the second half of the 20th century.
Okay.
Duke Ellington visited McLuhan at his coach house a couple of times.
No kidding.
Yeah, he was into McLuhan. And let's see, Leonard Cohen, when Canada put up the ANIC satellite, A-N-I-K, I don't know if it's the first communication satellite, first.
One of the first, yeah, the ANIC C, I think it was. Yeah,
yeah.
And that was in, was that in the 50s or early 60s?
No, early 70s, I think.
Oh, early 70s,
yeah.
You're right, yes.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting about that is they had a committee name the name, create the name, and
oh,
on the committee was Marshall McLuhan and Leonard Cohen.
Ah.
So there's McLuhan rubbing up against Cohen and
right.
and Zappa and
yep.
Bob Dylan. Did you know what Dylan said about McLuhan in Spin
no.
magazine about 1985? He said, if you want to know about the 60s, you read Norman Mailer and Marshall McLuhan.
Ah, interesting.
So for me, Dylan's a little smarter than he lets on that he is.
Oh, he's a lot smarter than people let on and that he does. He's always kind of created these masks that he wears.
But yes.
underneath all of that, if you dig a little deeper and you listen from time to time, like you'll get a sense of who he is.
Who was it? Somebody died recently, and this journalist wrote about the guy in New York City, and Dylan was with him. He's a friend of Dylan's. Lucien K. Trescott IV, does that mean anything to you? Is he a guy who wrote for the Village Voice? I think so. I think that's the name.
Maybe.
But here's what he tells the story of somebody, Norman Mailer, right. So Lucien knew Norman Mailer. Norman Mailer was having some Christmas party. Lucien was hanging out with the 1974. Five rain. What is it? Rainbow. Whatever Dylan was on tour. Remember when he was going around?
Oh,
the Rainbow Bridge or
no?
Rolling Thunder.
Rolling Thunder Review.
Right. So Lucien knew that Mailer was having a party and he wanted to go to it. So he was on the bus. They were rehearsing for. This is when Dylan was getting ready for this in the Village in the Bitter End or something. So. Dylan, some of the gang in the band, went over to Norman Mailer's. So as they were going up the steps, some guy complains about this woman, older woman, who's going too slowly,
mm-hmm.
too slowly, and they kind of urge this woman. So Dylan turns around, snaps at him, says, shut up, and basically told him to go back to the bus. And Lucien found out later that Dylan, the reason he said that is that he knew this woman was Lillian Hellman,
famous writer
from the 40s and
50s. Yeah, yeah.
And Lucien telling the story, when this article was just written a few months ago, when someone passed or for some reason for it, he said, that's when I realized that Dylan knew a lot about mainstream culture, book culture, you know, what was happening,
mm-hmm.
and the history of American culture, because mm-hmm. he knew, he had never met Lillian Hellman, but he knew who she was, and protected her from being hassled by some ignorant, you know, roadie or something in the group that was just pissed off that this woman was taking too long. So I think of that story as him being more aware. And now there's a new book. Do you read much about Dylan?
I try to.
Do you know the book, The Dylanologist?
I don't know the book, but I've heard of it.
Yeah.
Yeah,
there's a really good section in there, and I didn't know this until I read the book last year, that Dylan, there's this whole trend of critics noticing that Dylan is taking stuff from this and that, like plagiarizing. Well, it turns out when you get into it and the details, there are lines from movies and magazines, all kinds of modern media. He actually was composing like T.S. Eliot and James Joyce did. Stuff right out of the popular culture that people wouldn't think would be in poetry or in a song, and it was sort of like invisible, he used it. And so these critics, Dylan fans, are going through documenting all this reference, all these media references. He wasn't writing his own point of view. He was just taking imagery and
mm-hmm.
phrases from media. So there you look at the cover of maybe it's Bring It All Back Home, where he's sitting in a living room in front of a fireplace, and he's got all these magazines and stuff. That's where his weird content came from.
Ah.
And if you don't know that, that's an interesting thing to know about Dylan. And Zappa did that in a way, too. You just let the electric media talk to them and then bounce off it. You know what I mean?
But right.
Argue back
yes.
with it or make fun of it.
Right.
So if you don't know that about Dylan, it's very interesting that he was a lot more sophisticated than he was presented. It's just this guy who he himself says, I don't even know how I wrote that stuff. I don't know who that kid was. I was possessed.
Yeah.
He says that
yeah,
to Martin Scorsese, you know?
Right.
And another... He even says as early as the Rolling Stone interview with Jan Wenner in 69, he says, I wasn't aware as I should have been. He says that about what he was writing and doing in 4 or 5 years before. So,
right.
you know, if you look at his interviews and that, is more and more is coming out about him. He's maybe not what people think he is. And then maybe that's why he deserved the Nobel Prize. Oh, that's why a fucking the thing came out. I forgot. Yeah, he won the Nobel Prize. So people
that's
were
right.
remembering stuff.
And, right.
Oh, yeah, that's what this Lucian article was about. So he's hanging out with Norm Mailer, really happy to meet him. And
yep.
he said Dylan was not being his arrogant self. He was being the student. He's at this party with all these famous authors or friends of Norm Mailer, and he's just absorbing, talking, interviewing everybody, totally into meeting these authors. And none of them, this Lucian says, took Dylan seriously. And he says many of them, and Lucian knew them because he became an American writer, novelist. He said, I know most of them were all gearing to get the Nobel Prize one day and were pissed off later when they didn't get it.
Right.
You know, whoever these people are. I don't know if it's Philip Roth. Did he get one? I don't know. But whoever these guys
no
were, they were right. all at Norm's party. And Dylan was a nobody to them. And so Lucian says the ultimate irony is, you know, what, 50 years later, that little punk kid
got it.
Well, got it, and those guys didn't. And they'd probably be puzzled why. Well, maybe the school, maybe the Nobel Committee read the Dylanologist and saw, he had some interesting techniques, modern creative poetic techniques in his writing. So
absolutely.
So maybe that would be our last theme here. What the relationship between Zappa and Dylan is pretty interesting because there are people who really make a big deal out of Dylan and have no problem saying he's America's greatest poet and don't like Zappa. Then there are those that think Zappa is the greatest thing that ever happened in American culture and not that into Dylan. What would you say, how would you put the two together? I mean, you know that they met, and you talk about that in your book. You know, I don't know if you mentioned it, but the dog, remember the dog barked at him? And Zappa said in his recounting of the meeting, he said to Dylan, sorry, my dog doesn't like Christians. That's in the original story.
That's funny.
Right. So what, you know about that encounter. What do you make of them? Who would you vote if you had to? Who would you say is the more important artist, the more relevant, or the greater poet, or deserving of a Nobel Prize?
I would vote for Frank. I think that...
Now, why?
Why? Because he is someone, for at least for me, who actually, whose work continues to speak to me. Now, I'm not saying that Dylan's work doesn't continue to speak to me, but if you look at what the kind of things that Bob is recording right now, which are basically classic covers by Frank Sinatra,
right?
He can do that if he wants, and he does it reasonably well and all of that. But there's nothing new to that.
He's not anti-environmental. He's not being the serious.
That's
artist.
Right. He's not. Well, not anymore. Now, even Frank thought that he did because when he heard.
Like a Rolling Stone and that.
Like a Rolling and Subterranean Homesick Blues and all of that.
Yeah.
He said, wait a minute, this guy is shaking the foundation.
And
even
he's done
under
it.
Me.
He says he's
and
done
he did it.
I don't have
and
to be a, I don't have to go form the mothers.
Yeah, that's right. I don't have to do my part because he's already done it. But then, you know, that wouldn't have been answering his muse. But just again, to answer your question, I would vote for Frank because he was the guy that was continually challenging the norms of musical
and here's something you might say,
stuff like that.
You're not saying this, but I'll say it, and you might say this. He never had an identity crisis. Dylan went from one problem to the next in his own personal understanding of what he was doing. You know what I mean? He didn't like the fame. Now, he was the first to get it. He got it before Zappa did. And Zappa maybe withdrew a bit, but No, Frank did not end up hiding out in Woodstock and being
right.
People would come into Dylan's home and invade him, but they did it to Zappa's place too. He talks about it in his own autobiography, these
yes.
people coming
yeah.
around. So Frank, and
yeah.
then the famous story where he the guy comes with a gun. I mean, that's an incredible story, and Frank
yeah.
just disarms him. But Frank remains consistent all the way through, and doesn't, as far as we know, end up, so suddenly I have to be a Buddhist now. I can't take the world. I'm going to be a Buddhist. Or Dylan became a born-again Christian and all that. Dylan
right.
is more emotionally involved. He's like the canary. I would to take the pro Dylan side. He's the canary in the mine. He's the one who gets nailed
sure.
first, and it's tough on him. And then he has all these reactions. But and Zappa had the advantage of watching what happened to Dylan.
Mm.
Why is Dylan listed as an influence? There's for your reason, but also Zappa knew. Well, okay, he had that. I won't suffer the way Dylan did. I'll not have a bike accident or something and be strung out on drugs. And the
yeah.
and so Zappa remained conceptually continuous and did produce way more than Dylan in all the phases that goes through the decade dance of the last 40 years, all the different fads of each decade. He is responding to that. He's being anti-environmental to whatever's happening.
Right.
And the big thing today, do we say, I wish Bob Dylan would write a song on the write about the internet or about Donald Trump or something. That's
right.
The main thing here about Zappa is what I miss is he's not telling me what to make of the 90s, the 2000s, and all that's happened.
Oh, yeah, that's right. We miss his satire.
Yeah,
we miss his political perspective. We miss his astute way.
His interviews.
He was a great talker, and he enjoyed talking about all of these things.
And Dylan doesn't talk. Dylan's very withdrawn. So
he's very quiet. Yeah,
but
that doesn't mean that he's not thinking. That doesn't mean that he's not participating. It's just that means that we're not necessarily allowed into his world. He's constantly hiding. He's basically been hiding his entire career, if you want
right.
to put it that way, right? Because he's created all of these masks for himself. He's created all of these kind of identities.
Yeah.
To keep us guessing. But, I still adore Bob Dylan's music, you know, because, in many cases, the way he could turn a phrase, the way
yeah.
he could, you know,
he's done
make
great
a tune,
music.
He was done great music.
And he is, because of, Zappa says, if you do it long enough, you'll be acknowledged.
That's
he's
true.
Got the advantage right now of being around, and Frank isn't. So
yeah,
over
right.
time, he's going to be known as the 60s guy more than Frank, maybe in pop culture, and maybe not in serious university courses and stuff. Zappa may
right.
have the edge there, but
right.
Dylan is still going, so that impresses
yep.
people. So he's got
yep.
that going for him. But the it's anemic what he does. It's
mm-hmm.
nice a little bit here and there. Joker Man's a good song, and maybe everybody makes a big deal out of Time Out of Mind, that album that came out in 97. I heard it once. Nothing stuck with me. Maybe I got to go
right.
back and listen to it.
Right.
He's like sporadic. He suddenly does something great, and then there's a lot of silly, not-so-good stuff.
Right.
And he's not. He's actually a book guy. He's a writer, and so... He was very neo-Luddite, about dealing with technology. That's why he came around to Frank, to get updated with what to do with the studio.
Yeah, he wanted to do something different.
Right, and whereas Frank was always the leading edge. And since this is a technological virtual reality society, Frank survives as a virtual reality response more than Dylan, in terms of dealing with the technology. I've been told by interesting people that Zappa's music can be better appreciated now because the technology is better to hear what he embedded in the music 30, 40 years ago.
Yes.
Think of that. We can hear more, Frank.
Oh, yeah.
In this ancient stuff that when it gets remastered or whatever they do to make it, whatever new equipment allows us to hear more, he's got that. So for me, it's no question Zappa's the greatest artist. And maybe it's a tribute to him that he never will get acknowledged because he's forever anti-environmental.
That's right.
As soon as you're
acknowledged, it's over.
Right. That's right. And
in a way.
Even
yeah.
McLuhan said that. Success is the biggest failure. And
failure is that what McLuhan would define as success in this particular case?
I think he means mainstream, getting awards, being
right.
an Grease, the normal established form of, getting the Kennedy Center to do a special on you.
Oh,
that's
when it's over.
That's when it's over, McLuhan said. He even said back in the 40s that he went back to Canada. There was two reasons. He didn't make the first one too obvious. He didn't want to fight in World War II. And it was getting to the point he was working in St. Louis, and 43, 44, he was maybe going to get drafted. So he goes back to Canada pretty quickly.
Right.
But the other reason is he says, I got to go to a backwards place where I'm not hassled by popularity and New York City media and that, and I can maintain my purity of vision. I'm not distracted by being too famous. That's Dylan's problem. He has to go around, I guess he apparently does, goes and he has a restaurant in L.A. and he goes to and plays billiards anonymously, you know, covers himself up, not allowed to talk to him. But he has that pressure of having to observe people while they're looking at you. It's better to be anonymous.
And so it is better to be anonymous, yes.
To see what, so you can see things. There is an interesting story about Dylan found wandering in the New Jersey hinterlands a couple of years ago, and he got arrested by cops because they didn't know what he was doing. And then they found out it was Dylan. But I like to think that he was he goes off the beaten path to recover the his artistic perceptions. Now, I'll end with this point. Have you ever read the story at the back of John Wesley Harding, which came out in 68?
I've got that album. I guess I need to refresh on that. But
yeah, do you have it? Well, is yours alphabetical or not? No.
Oh, well, I don't have the I got that on CD. I can actually reach for it in a second if you want to wait.
No, that's all right. You can look it up. I think you can even Google it.
I'll look it up after.
Yeah, you can even Google it. So it's a story about three kings. And in the 60s, his liner notes talked about what the scene, New York, Andy Warhol, whatever. He even mentions one of McLuhan's phrases in 64, 65. So he's talking about the world around him. And so it seems to be the last album he does that is John Wesley Harding. So this is about 1967 because it's recorded the end of 67, early 68 comes out. So it's about three kings visiting Frank, and they're coming to find out what's Frank's magic. Now, this is when Frank is playing at the Garrick Theater through the summer of 67, April to, say, September, right?
Yeah.
So Dylan, definitely, he's up in Woodstock supposedly recovering, but he knows what's going on. People are talking, and everybody's talking about Frank in that period. So he's going to comment. My theory is he will comment on what's in at the time. So in it, you'll read closely, it says, Frank is in, the three kings come, and they got their question to Frank, and Frank is in the kitchen dishing himself out. Dishing himself out. Now think of Frank, always said, it's always an extension of me. It's all my stuff. But what it says is dishing, might have to look it up, dishing himself out the meat. This is when he was recording Uncle Meat.
Yep.
And maybe Tom Wilson or somebody, they're around Frank. They know what he's going to call it or something. He's got an Uncle Meat, Ezra, whatever her name is, playing Uncle Meat in the band, right?
Yeah.
You know, Ezra Mohawk is her name? Ezra something. You know, the girl who played Uncle Meat in the Garrick days. Do you remember her? Ezra is her name. Ezra Mohawk or something.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. So anyways, Dylan could find out on the gossip circuit what's going on. He could know about Uncle Meat. And here's what it is. Preparing the meat and dishing himself out. Not dishing out the meat. He's dishing himself out. So you put the two together, it's Uncle Meat, right? And he's in the studios.
Yeah. There you go,
And then at the end, they ask the king, the kings ask Frank to answer. So what Frank does is he gooses himself around the room and does all these absurd antics. Theatrical antics. Now, that's how people would perceive Garrick Theater, absolutely free, fixed and repugnant.
Yeah.
As Zaff and the Mothers, you know, pluking themselves and jumping around, you know, like a bunch of jumping rabbits or something, doing these crazy antics, physical antics. So Zappa's performance in that summer, Frank dishing himself out, is exactly how Dylan portrays Frank. Or is that how portrays his Frank? I think it's a commentary on Frank. So it ends with one of the kings saying, well, did you have to be so ridiculous? And this is Dylan's answer to Frank, because Dylan's going simple.
Yes.
You know, he's leaving the whole psychedelic scene, and he's taking advantage of being the rumor that he's half dead, and he's going country with Johnny Cash and being simple. He's not with the counterculture psychedelic anarchy, so to speak. So it is actually a understandable point that Dylan is making about Zappa from Dylan's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So check it out. It's a pretty. It's something that's never been noticed in the Zappa world.
No.
And I'm not saying I'm right, but
it's worth considering.
Yeah,
based on the timing of it. And
yeah.
The rest of it.
Now I never got a chance to say this to Dylan. So when he performed in Toronto in the 80s, it might have been. Could it have been 78, but maybe he came back in the 80s. Somewhere's in there.
Yeah,
like Dylan was, Zappa was playing at the Maple Leaf Gardens within a month of Dylan. So his comeback was 1974, but in my mind it's later.
Later.
Anyways, so I go see Dylan, and I get backstage. He's hiding. You can't get to see Dylan, but the musicians and that are around. And they're getting on the bus. So I go into the bus and I say, okay, you guys, I want you to ask Dylan if John was your hearting, the story in the back is about Frank Zappa. Okay? And so
yes.
I laid it out, and a couple of guys said, yeah, well, we'll do that. Who knows if they're going to, but I said that. So then I'm standing out with my friend, and all of a sudden the rest of the band's coming into the bus, and there's Dylan. And he's this little short guy with his head down. He doesn't want to talk to anybody. He's like hiding as he walks in the bus. So as he walks by, I said, Bob, ask him about John Wesley Harding. He ignores me when he goes in. So I reinforced it right to him, but he has not gotten back to me whether I was right or not.
Oh. I hope you don't have to wait too much longer.
Oh, I'll find out. Once
find
I'm
out.
Famous, he'll want to hang out with me. And then I'll
But then it'll be all over.
What will?
You'll be all over if he's if you become famous. Then it's all over.
For him.
And he's all over.
He's all over. That's right.
He's
He'll write a poem about me.
There you go.
Yeah, they have a little notice on his website.
Right.
Bob Dobbs is a replay of Frank Zappa.
A retread.
Yeah.
You're a replay, but not a retread.
Yeah. And he'll say, Bob, why don't you goose yourself around a little more? He'll take the opposite view of me.
Yikes.
And I'm not goofy myself. I like here in Maui. I'm staying here in Maui. I don't need to go anywhere else.
Well, it seems to have been a very good move for you.
Yeah,
and your
I'm
wife.
Very happy
and,
here.
You've been there for how many years now?
8 years.
8 years 2008 already.
We came here, yeah.
Wow. I can see.
And I just started taking some. I took some surfing lessons the other day, so I'm going to start doing that. Yeah.
Well, you might as well.
Yeah, it's the opportunity's here.
Good for you.
Okay, so let me see. Is there anything about your book and what's happened to you since you're known to produce it that you've thought, that you knew, thought, well, I'd like to say this if I ever get interviewed. What's something that you have, that got left out or something that you...
Well, I when you write a book and you realize that you've left some stuff out, we had mentioned a little earlier about the Garrick Theater years. There's nothing in my book about the Garrick Theater years.
Well, that's early stuff. That's what the earlier books
do. Yeah, that's true. That's what the earlier books do, but I wanted to revisit that. And I thought of that after the fact, you know. You think before today? Oh,
you're
saying
I left that out.
I accidentally omitted all of that. And it was like, you know, because you get so wound up in different things, you get distracted, and next thing you know, you're working on a deadline. You got to get it done. But the notion of looking and exploring the Garrick Theater years, I think, was worthy of a chapter in and of itself. And that would have meant, in my case, including a few stories there. But because we know so much more about that time now, and in fact, there are probably some bootleg recordings out there, but I could have looked up some archival stories in the Village Voice, for instance, and maybe talked to some people who were there or somehow to get a better sense of what that time was as the kind of the Mothers of Invention incubation period.
Yeah, yeah. And they were at Environmental. They were the best
absolutely.
Theater going.
Absolutely, and the young people were tuning in on that, and they were digging it. You know, people like Ian Underwood, if it hadn't been for the Garrick Theater, Ian Underwood would never have discovered him.
That's right.
You know, for instance, and Ian became a very important musical partner.
Right.
So I would have included stuff like that, and then would have probably reached a lot deeper with where some of the players are, you know, the people, you know, as you mentioned, like Pansy and all the rest of it. To get a better sense, maybe to get some more of the inside track. And then I could have included more things from his brother's book.
Yes.
Which I would have included because that's quite charming. You know, those things, and maybe incorporated perhaps some of the things that we've discussed regarding conceptual continuity, and then your notions and ideas regarding McLuhan and all of that.
Yeah.
You know, I would have loved to have included something about that in some shape or form, just by way of context, because I think that in retrospect, the book in and of itself is the big picture and a door for people to get into Frank Zappa's music, but it's not. I'm not a completist, and I wasn't going to be a completist because that would be futile.
Yeah.
Because it just leads you to other things. That said, I think that it would have been fun to explore some of the more personal aspects about Frank and his interest in science and in communications and McLuhan and all of that. I think would have been interesting to sort of fill out the picture a bit more.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, one time I was with him and I brought up McLuhan. I said, this is way back in the early 70s, and I said, you ever read McLuhan? And he says, yes, I read that little black book when it came out, which is 1967, 68. He says, I read that little black book on the airplane one day.
Yeah.
So that's right when he is becoming famous, and he has to deal with this media starting to take over in American life. He may have gotten some ideas from McLuhan. We have in the 80s, he says, I used to have this in my own video bootleg collection. He says in an interview, the media is all there is. That's what he said.
Yeah.
The media is all there is. So he understood this virtual global theater that was taking over the global village.
Yes.
Then, when I was with him in 1980, let me see, so then I saw him in November in Halifax, and he said he liked the May Brussels stuff. I then was with him in March 85 at his studio, and he connected me with McLuhan. He said, hey, I just saw that documentary on McLuhan, which his daughter had done, 1984. It has interviews with Trudeau and Norm Mailer and everybody.
Oh, right.
It's a pretty good documentary with lots of footage. So so Stephanie made that, and it got played on PBS. And Zappa says, you know, I saw that.
Yeah.
And he says, you know, McLuhan, he'd never seen McLuhan before, you know, in any video. So he says, McLuhan didn't look like he was all there.
That's true.
Yeah, and I said, well, you have to realize McLuhan was a total actor. That he did not believe, he wasn't promoting a theory. He was being anti-environmental. It would depend on who he's talking to. You'll see him a totally different guy with Tom Snyder than with the guy you would have known, the guy in the 80s on TV Ontario, Mike McManus. Yeah, McManus. In that interview, McLuhan looks a little odd. But McLuhan was acting, and no one knew it. He was following the script and then adapting it. So I tried to say, well, what you saw, this not all there, that was the detached level of McLuhan that he was acting. So he didn't know what to say to that.
How do you respond to that? Yeah.
He didn't know what I meant, really. Or he didn't know what to say. He didn't have anything to say at that point.
Sure.
But that's my interplay about McLuhan with Frank, is that he read the book at the time when everybody was reading McLuhan and read that little paperback called The Medium is the Massage.
Mm-hmm.
And then he saw the documentary, and he paid attention to it. He watched it and decided, McLuhan, there's something off about McLuhan. But I don't know, maybe some of the stuff Frank was saying that McLuhan was saying Frank didn't like. Because when the PMRC, what was it, the early 90s? When's the PMRC? 85. Well,
85.
Something about the censorship. When I was at Jerry Fiala's in the early 90s, there was this activist. Now, wait, that's sort of, maybe it was 88. Yeah, it must have been 88. This activist woman helping Frank out there, you know, trying to stop censorship and this and that. When I stated to Jerry what McLuhan would say about that, no, actually it was to her. We got her on the phone. She says, that's exactly what we're against. That's ridiculous, blah, blah, blah. And she didn't like the sophisticated way McLuhan would modulate different media environments. It was like too technocratic management type. It ignored the, well, we have the right to do what we want to do, you know, and say and be, what about freedom of expression? So on the level, so I took that woman who was, Frank liked her helping him, getting his objection to censorship out in the media. Her literal misinterpretation of McLuhan, or not seeing the relevance of it, thought it was too sophisticated and not dealing with the basic issues. Frank might have been simple on that level and didn't get McLuhan's complicated, what's called tetrad management.
I don't know if you know
about McLuhan's tetrad. It's complicated for many people how McLuhan. As a matter of fact, the CIA used the tetrad later. They called it sociological algorithms. Bush gave this stuff to Gorbachev when they met in Malta in December 89.
Okay.
Post the Berlin Wall coming down. Gorbachev wanted these sociological algorithms for managing the breakup of the empire, and with all these new countries retrieving, or these slave colonies retrieving their national identity and what they'll go through. That's laid out in McLuhan's algorithm.
Wow.
They'll like retrieve ancient national identity right when it's obsolete. And that kind of complication. So so I find it interesting that Zappa did not get McLuhan in the 80s, thought there was something odd. But McLuhan was odd anyways. So who knows what
part of his charm.
Yeah, part of his charm and part of his difficulty. And Frank had ESP, so maybe Frank knew
there
more.
You go. He did. There you go. Well, thanks very much, Bob. I got to go.
All right. Well, that's very good, John. Thanks for the pretty comprehensive dialogue.
Well, I appreciate it. It's always a pleasure. I'm glad we were able to reconnect, especially over Frank, because that's always...
Yeah, this is a conversation we should have had 30 years ago.
Well, I wouldn't have been as prepared. You would have been fine, but
yeah, I was okay.
As prepared.
So
yeah, you were okay.
Okay. Let me stop the recording, then I want to say something to you.
Okay.
Just another minute. Okay, we'll stop it. Thanks to John Curcelli for a great interaction on his creative output, and we hope to hear more from John. Okay, let's see. We end here.